bear with me. On the right-hand side on the Oregon Legislative page, there's a link to say video.
There we are. Good morning, everybody. We're going to open the House Interim Committee on Veterans Services and Emergency Preparedness.
We're going to open the Senate Interim Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. What we're going to do, if you see your schedule in the beginning, do you have a comment?
Yes, I do.
Before we proceed, the Vice Chair of the Setran, the veteran side of this joint hearing, generally makes some opening comments, and I'm going to allow her to do so now.
This is sometimes, Senator Lori Montes-Anderson and I always like to read just something that's written by our National Guard from Voices of the Guard, and this is under the chapter Coping. Holidays brings coping skills, but those that are overseas, our military also have coping skills, and this is what one of the guardsmen wrote. He said, "The last thing you want to do before you go out on a mission is call your wife. I never do that, ever. I call her when I got back. If you start thinking about your wife and kids, you're going to get yourself or somebody else killed. You put them in a suitcase in your head, and you think about what you're doing. My wife sent me tapes of just her and my little boy talking, hanging out, and I'd play those tapes when I got a chance. I'd go to sleep listening to their little voices." Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. For members of the public, colleagues, the agenda, we're going to deviate just slightly from this and try and clean up some work on the Senate side before I hand the gavel over to my esteemed co-chair to the right. We have about, I think, 12 or 13 Senate committee, some House member bills and things and legislative concepts that we're going to try and introduce later this morning. Before I turn it over to counsel to review those, and she's going to then, I think, pass the buck to several members on the House side, the Senate is going to attempt to introduce these 12 or 13 bills as committee bills. Unfortunately, and I apologize in advance, we are short of a quorum at the moment on the Senate side. We're hoping to fix that problem and find one member to get in here. What we're going to do is go through the legislative concepts, both on the Senate side and then the House members on their side, and then we're going to, at a later point, as soon as I can find a third Senate member, again, I apologize, and we get a quorum on our side, we'll stop where we are in the process and do a quick work session on the Senate side so that we can get those bills introduced and that processing going on. Madam Counsel.
Chairs, members of the committee, there are a handful of Senate side committee bills. There are no House side committee bills. And so and that's a failure on my part. I didn't account for a possible work session on the House side. So House members, if they spontaneously wanted to make a request, Representative Boone has a handful, and they're going to be covered, introduced on the Senate side since I failed to have a possible work session on the House side. So the work session will only be Senate side, and we'll wait for Representative Olson to do that. The handful of Senate side committee bills are LC 1181, and this is the work group concept that the committees have both been updated on in previous legislative days, dealing with the veterans' preference and job interviews for veterans. There's an update later on the agenda today. That's the concept that they've worked on. LC 1515. Is a redraft of a bill from last session authorizing the establishment of firearms training facilities on lots or parcels that are exclusive farm use zones. LC 1517 excludes a veteran's disability benefits from the calculation of spousal support and domestic relations actions. This is also a redraft from last session. And then there are three placeholders, LC 1520, 1521, and 1522. So they have broad relating clauses relating to veterans, Department of Veterans Affairs, and Oregon Military Department, respectively. And if Representative Boone would care to discuss any of hers that she's seeking introduction on the Senate side for.
And did you want to do that now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I have invited several people to do this for me.
Okay.
If that's all right.
We're at your pleasure.
Okay. And I don't know if you have it in any particular order or not.
We're at your pleasure.
Oh, all right. So I would call Mark Sanssouci and maybe Cameron Smith and any of the military folks in the back who would like to weigh in on any of these. And Let me see if I can try to find the right. I've got two here. Legislative Council draft. Oh, help me out here.
1584.
Thank you.
2697.
Okay, and 2697. Thanks, Mark. So I'm going to select Mr. Sanssouci. Talk about these just briefly for us, and he's probably going to be able to take questions as well. Thank you.
Good morning, chairs, vice chairs, future chairs. Thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Mark Sanssouci. I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for the Northwest, retired Air Force guy, and the two issues we're working with Representative Boone and hopefully get the support of your committees. 1584 is about military student identifier. We have 1.1 million military kids in schools, but we don't know where all of them are or how many there are in different places unless they're high-impact aid-receiving school districts. What we're asking for is a code, a field in the code that asks if you have kids that are military-connected, active duty, and guard reserve. The reason is we'd like to know how they're performing in school, if they're more absent than other kids based on deployments, things like that. We think this is a minimal cost because the code we're not asking for an accountable subgroup, which is a whole different deal. We're asking for a report-only requirement. And 97% of school districts already have the information systems in place to do this. So we're hoping that here in Oregon it'll be a minimal cost thing. The Department of Defense in fiscal year 14 awarded $46.6 million to 44 school districts for STEM grants, for special education related studies, foreign languages. And so the first step in any school district that has some military kids asking for help would be to know how many there are. And that's kind of the point of this whole thing. So I stand for any questions on that one. There's certainly a lot more, but I know that in the interest of time, I can't go on.
Co-chair, any questions?
I have none.
Any questions of other members? Send aside. Thank you. Please go on.
The next one is LC-2697, and it's about Medicaid waiver help for military families with special needs children. We kicked this one off in 2014, and five states passed it, including Washington State and Alaska. This one is really just about military families with special needs kids. TRICARE ECHO does not cover all of their needs. Abstinence supplies, respite care, a list of things that TRICARE ECHO does not cover, which causes that family to go to the local Medicaid office and look for home and community-based waivers. I've been working with some special needs groups up in Washington State, and one of them has done a national study, and in many states, the waiting list, once they're eligible for the benefit, is years long. Sometimes they PCS or they move to their next assignment, and they never really receive that benefit. So what we've been looking to do is just to say, if a family is a resident, in this case in Oregon, if there's an Oregon military family that are Oregon residents with special needs dependents, they establish the eligibility, they get put on the list, but then they have to move to perform military duties, that they retain their eligibility on that list, in a sense, a placeholder position. So then when they come back, when they're finished with military, retired, they still hold that position. They can be reevaluated, but at least not have them start all over again, which is what the families typically have done. I work with a family with Down syndrome, came back to Washington State and had to prove that they had a Down syndrome kid all over again, which kind of is unnerving to the family. So that's essentially what that one seeks to accomplish, and I stand for any questions.
Mr. Co-Chair, questions? Councilmembers, questions? Representative Boone, please.
Thank you, and I apologize, Mark. I neglected to give you a really judicious introduction. We, on the committee, at least in the House, have seen Mr. Sanssouci in committee helping us get bills through, mostly involving around families and reintegration, stuff like that. And he works around the country doing this, so has been very good, very thorough, wonderful to work with. Thank you.
Representative Huffman, question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I go back to the first LC? Mark, what did we do last? I think the 2013 session, didn't we deal with the transfer of school kids and tracking them? Or did we just talk about the need to do it in 2013?
I think we talked about it. We didn't do it.
Okay.
No. We did the Interstate Compact in 2014, which is relevant but not the same issue.
Okay. Any other questions on the House side? Senate side? Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you,
Representative
Mr. Chair.
I have four more from you on my list. Right. Please proceed.
Yes. So I think we'll call up the resilience folks next, and that would be the Jays and Dr. Rubin and Dr. Vicky. And I'm trying to get this. Okay, that's done. Bear with me. So we have Legislative Council draft 1898, 1894, and 1599. Maybe there's only three. And yeah.
Are we 1898 or 1893?
1893.
Okay, good.
And this is the. No, I've got the wrong. I'm sorry. Let me.
Okay, if you're related to 1893, please come to the diocese.
Well, let's just call them up and do all the resilience ones together. That makes sense.
Okay. And they are?
Yes. I'm sorry, Mark.
Representative.
Council, please.
Members, I'd be happy to
Decide
related
please
to
proceed.
Because I've got other committees
there
that
are
mixed in. Sorry.
That's all right, Representative Boone. It is not a hearing on these bills. Again, it's merely for purposes of introduction that we're getting a quick summary. Representative Boone's remaining measures that she's seeking to have introduced by the Senate Veterans Committee are LC 1599, LC 1604, LC 1893, and LC 2446. And in order, I'll recite their relating to clauses, and all these measures are available on OLIS and were emailed to the members. LC 1599 requires reimbursement for up to 60-day supply of prescription drugs for chronic conditions, so that, of course, relates to emergency preparedness. LC 1604 directs the Land Conservation and Development Commission to require local governments in which there are communities at substantial risk of experiencing severe impact from a tsunami inundation to plan for tsunami resilience. LC 1893 is relating to financing improvements for seismic rehabilitation. LC 2446.
That's the fuel. Manual distribution
relates
of fuel.
To backup systems at fuel dispensaries.
Okay, and Representative, you have
so okay. We'll start with the doing an order 1599, which is the it's one of the resilience plan's recommendations. So, Dr. Rubin, Jay Raskin, Jay Wilson are welcome to come up. And Dr. Rubin is a chair of the resilience task force that was in charge with implementing the resilience plan.
Which we'll hear from later.
Yes.
For only reference to the LCs, please.
Right. This is just the 30-day or
brevity
or
is
more.
Fast moving.
This is the prescription.
Prescriptions.
Drugs.
Stash of prescription drugs.
So my name is Jeff Rubin. I am the emergency manager for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, as well as vice chair for the Resilience Task Force. For this particular item, it's regardless of the type of disaster or emergency, we know that one of the most reliable impacts, or one of the impacts that happen more often, even if it's a simple power outage, is people being isolated from their healthcare network, whether it's prescription drugs or anything else, dialysis, etc. And for depending on your plan, you may have a significant challenge getting a 30-day supply that you can maintain. So this is simply to facilitate that, so that we are not seeing people with normally chronic, stable medical conditions becoming unstable and acute at the worst possible time when they can't get access to a hospital.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative, other ones?
The next bill?
Yes, please.
Okay. So then this is the placeholder for the resilience plan implementation. It would be 1604. And this is a broad. It was a placeholder for the plan itself, which is, we'll hear from later, but has hundreds of pages of we don't want to go into.
Which we're not going to do today.
No, but what they produced was a series of recommendations to the legislature for implementation of the plan, and this is the overall bill. So if you wanted to speak
LC
to that.
LC 1604.
Good morning, Representative Boone. My name is Jay Wilson, the chair of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission. In the Oregon Resilience Plan, we strongly recommended the need for local planning, assistance for local planning, land use planning, zoning, updates that deal with especially earthquake and tsunami issues. There are no communities like the communities on the coast that faced the potentiality of their need to completely be reconstructed from the ground up following this event that we're preparing for. So we support and advocate for investments in supporting land use planning and zoning in coastal communities.
Thank you. Questions, members? Good. Representative Boone?
Okay, and you can see why I'm having other people introduce these. They're much more articulate than I could be. I think the next one, I will skip down to 2446. This is the manual distribution of fuel provided during an emergency or outage.
I'll take that one as well. This was, we know that one of our greatest vulnerabilities in Oregon post-earthquake is going to be liquid fuels, both for transportation and generators. And this was simply a provision for wholesale and retail fuel vendors to have an electrical transfer switch so that a generator could be hooked in and be able to pump from underground storage tanks. It's not asking to have a generator, simply to install the electrical transfer switch that public agency or others could attach a generator to.
Questions, House members? Senate members?
Okay, and so for the final one, I have a different panel coming up, so thank you all. And Elizabeth Edwards for LC 1893, which is the local government's PACE program expand to include seismic retrofits. And if you brought anybody with you, they're welcome to come also.
Okay. Just me today.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Chair Bacchus, Chair Matthews, members of the committee, Elizabeth Edwards on behalf of the City of Portland. It's really nice to be before you. I feel like I'm at home. So LC 1893 would allow local governments to partner with private lenders in order to create loans for multifamily and commercial buildings. The City of Portland has over 1,000 unreinforced masonry buildings. These are structures that have brick on the outside, and in the event of a major seismic event, it's a serious threat to both folks inside the building and outside the building. It's also a major threat for our economic vitality and recovery after an event, trying to clean up these buildings that don't have reinforced masonry. So we hope to work with private lenders, create tools in order to have extra cash flow coming in and get some of these buildings retrofitted, which are otherwise prohibitively expensive to do.
Thank you. Questions, House members?
Representative Boone, please. I wanted to just add, too, that I'd had another group come forward and ask to do another bill, but they're now going to collaborate with this group, and they're with the historical buildings, and Portland has quite a few of those, but there are around the state quite a few others. And they were going to do a standalone bill, but decided to join in with this one. And, you know, with the interest of keeping our history alive and all that, and hopefully that will happen, that they'll stand. But if they were not reinforced and fell down, that would be kind of a shame, just because they're not reinforced. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you. And for the record, House and Senate members, that LC draft that Representative Boone was just discussing is LC 1893, dated 10/27/14, which is it on the list?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, if anyone wants to take a look at a hard copy, as you know, votes to introduce are not votes on the content, but this is our first look at this. We'll post it up to OLIS as quickly as you can, but if anybody wants to take a look at the hard copy, we've got it right here, right now. Then we'll get it up on the
any takers on the House side?
Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Boone, please.
I just want to comment, these hearings, well, they're not hearings, but these informational meetings are always difficult to prepare for in the midst of holidays, because our minds are just coming off of turkey coma and going into gift buying and all that. So,
well, Representative Boone, thanks for the smack on the Senate side here, because we appear to have two members that are on holiday right now, and we apologize for that.
Just a hint.
We have one more legislative council draft, 1587, on the Senate side. Senator Monis Anderson.
Thank you, committee. This is may or may not be heard. I was supposed to be in my health committee, and it was inadvertently left off of my list. It has to go deal with insurance and the Oregon Education Benefits Board.
Questions, House members? You don't know either, so see. Again, for the record, members of both committees and the public, at a later point this morning, we're hoping to reach a quorum on the Senate side, and then the list of LCs we just reviewed will stop at that point so that we don't lose a quorum and introduce those bills at that point. And again, I just want to point out that even though you've heard this on the record here before both committees, they would be Senate bills. And the second thing on the Senate side, and a vote in favor for merely introducing legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept, and it's not indicative of the measure's opinion or position. It's simply an introduction for future use in the committee. With that, I'm going to go ahead and excuse myself till I can find a quorum, and I'm going to turn it over to my esteemed colleague, Representative Matthews. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good luck in your search. And thank you for coming. As we begin today's informational meetings, you'll notice I believe there's like seven different topics on the agenda. So we are going to ask you to keep your comments fairly brief, if you will, in respect to the others that we're going to present as well. We will go down the list as presented on the agenda. I will say, if you're one of our last presenters and we still don't have a quorum, we might ask you just to continue to speak, and we'll see how that goes. A filibuster, if you will. So all that and much, much more coming your way this morning. So thank you for being here, and we will start with an informational meeting, and we'll open the informational meeting, and we'll start with Oregon's Pandemic Preparedness Response and the Oregon Health Authority. Can we please have Michael Tynan, Dr. Paul, is it Cieslak, and Rod Calkins, please step forward. Thank you. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Am I on?
You are.
Chair Matthews, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Paul Cieslak. I'm the medical director for the communicable disease and immunization programs within the Oregon Public Health Division. We have a slideshow for your viewing pleasure today to talk about pandemic preparedness in general, and also about what we've been doing with Ebola in particular, because that's been on our minds lately. How do we advance the slides? There we go. First, a little introduction into what we do in epidemiology at the Public Health Division in attempts to control communicable diseases. The public health person's worldview of communicable diseases looks kind of like this. You have a host, you have a pathogen, a germ, a virus, a bacterium, and it lives somewhere in nature. It lives within a reservoir. And then on the right side of the slide, you have a host. That's one of us who may or may not be susceptible to the infection. And then in some means or another, the germ or the pathogen has to get to the host. So basically, when we think about how to control these things, we can think about eliminating the reservoir for the disease, or we can think about interrupting the transmission. That may involve addressing vectors like mosquitoes that transmit it, or maybe it's a foodborne disease and we pull the product from the market. Or we can try to immunize the host, or otherwise prepare the host to render him no longer susceptible to the disease. Next slide. So when we hear about a new infection, there are several approaches that we take in order to get answers to the questions that we have about it. First of all, we tend to set up disease tracking systems. We are able to specify what diseases have to be reportable in the state of Oregon. You're probably aware that diseases like meningococcal disease and syphilis and E. coli 0157 infection, whenever they're diagnosed by a laboratory or a physician, are required to be reported to public health authorities by law, and they undertake an investigation and control measures. The data go into a database so that we're able to track the diseases and look at things like geographic and temporal trends. Is it affecting all parts of Oregon or just one part? Is the disease going up or is it going down? We're able to do population analyses. So is it affecting women more than men, old people more than young people? And we're also able to look at risk factors. For example, you know, if you're in daycare, are you at a particular risk for E. coli O157 infection, or if you're a healthcare worker? And obviously, there are prevention measures to be taken should you find any of those risk factors. Because we watch the data on a regular basis, we're able to detect when the case counts are rising and when there's an outbreak. And obviously, if there's an outbreak, we want to find out how is it being transmitted and take steps to prevent it. Often, we're left with doing literature reviews. In the case of Ebola, we've had no experience, thank God, with Ebola in the state of Oregon. So to learn something about it, we're going back and rereading papers that were published in the 1970s and the 1990s about major outbreaks that occurred in Africa. How were those diseases transmitted? When all else fails, we call our friends at CDC and try to get some expert opinion. Probably on a daily basis, someone in my office is talking to CDC about some disease or another. And then finally, we can undertake special studies as needed to address issues of particular concern. The goal of all of this is to develop some rational prevention steps for the lay public, for the healthcare workers to protect themselves, and for public policy. And when I say rational, I mean something that works, something that's feasible, something that hopefully is proportionate in terms of how much it costs to prevent how much disease. Next slide. Moving on to Ebola virus in West Africa, a little primer on Ebola. The incubation period, the period between the time a person gets exposed to Ebola and the time you come down with symptoms, when we say the virus is incubating within your body, is up to 21 days. If you've been exposed to the virus and you haven't come down ill within 21 days, you've dodged the bullet and you're going to escape it. So it's really that 21-day period that we're interested in watching people following exposure. What does the disease look like? 3 or 4 days after you've been exposed, you tend to feel lousy. We call it malaise. You may develop muscle aches and joint pains. And then a period of more intense illness will set in with fever. You'll develop vomiting, abdominal cramping, diarrhea, ultimately perhaps a lot of bleeding, usually from the intestinal tract. When death happens, it usually happens about 10 days into one's illness, and it's caused by losing a lot of fluids, both by vomiting and diarrhea, but also because there's kind of a sepsis picture, which means your blood vessels get leaky. So we can put IV fluids into your blood vessels, but the fluid just leaks out into your tissues and you can't maintain blood pressure anymore. And when death occurs, that's the mechanism for death. In this current outbreak in Africa, which is by far the largest ever reported to date, I think the previous high was something like 400 cases. There have been 17,256 cases reported as of last week, with more than 6,000 deaths. So the case fatality rate is 35%. About 35% of the cases we know about have been fatal. That's a whopping high case fatality rate. Meningococcal disease, which is a very serious disease, has about a 10% case fatality rate. So this gives you some notion of how nasty this disease is. Here in the United States, if I could go to the next slide. We're following people as they come into the country so that travelers from the Ebola-affected countries in West Africa are now being funneled through 5 major airports in the eastern part of the country. Those are Chicago O'Hare, JFK in New York, Newark, New Jersey, Dulles outside of Washington, D.C., and Atlanta Hartsfield. And they're being screened and asked a bunch of questions about their risk factors and whether they have any symptoms or not. If they have symptoms, they're being held at that entry airport and not allowed to proceed to their final destination. If they're asymptomatic, in general, they are being allowed to proceed to their final destination. And we get their names, and we forward those to the local health departments in Oregon, and they maintain daily contact with them. Any travel restrictions are based on the level of risk that they had. So, you know, a very low level of risk, which most of our patients have had so far, means I set foot in Liberia. That would be a low risk. Okay, we're going to watch you for 21 days, but we're not going to restrict your travel. On the other hand, a very high level of risk might be I cared for an Ebola patient and I wasn't wearing any personal protective equipment. Next slide. These data are as of the end of last week. I can update them for you because we got a couple of new people in from West Africa over the weekend. To date, we've had 15 people come into the state of Oregon from Ebola-affected countries. Of those, 13 were mere travelers, if you will, and 2 were healthcare workers. And the status of their monitoring is that 11 have completed their 21-day monitoring period and did not develop Ebola. 2 of them left the state, and we transferred their monitoring to the receiving state health department, and 2, which just came on in over this past weekend, are still being monitored, and they'll continue to be monitored till the end of December. Next slide. So I think the main messages are that for the U.S. public, there is essentially no risk from Ebola virus. A couple of thousand people have come into the country from those Ebola-affected nations in West Africa, and we've had 9 cases of Ebola in the United States to date. 5 of those were brought in for treatment. In any case, among all the people who were potentially exposed, the only 2 who contracted the illness while in the United States were those 2 nurses in Dallas caring for a known Ebola patient in the terminal phases of illness. None of the casual contacts, in fact, none of the family members of those people have contracted illness. And it's information like this, as well as what's published in the literature from the previous studies, that let us know that it really requires direct contact and really contact with blood or body fluids in order to come down with an Ebola infection. It's not spread by casual contact or the airborne route or anything like that. So the prevention really has to center around the healthcare workers who are caring for these people in the later stages of illness. And we ask them to have to gown up with impermeable gowns such that they have no skin exposure whatsoever. They should wear face shields. They should practice the donning and doffing of this personal protective equipment. They should do it under direct supervision, somebody standing there with a checklist. Okay, now put your gloves on, now put this on. For aerosol-generating procedures, you know, if you're going to be suctioning the patient in the hospital such that you might get spritzed, then you should have an N95 or better mask for airborne disease protection. But otherwise, that's not required. If you're really interested in all the extensive detail of what's required for this gowning and gloving, you can watch the video that is at that web link, and they go through it in detail. Okay, I'll turn it over to Michael Tynan. Thank you.
So, Representative Matthews, Senator Boquist, my name is Michael Tynan. I'm the Policy Director for the Public Health Division, and for the past 8 weeks, I've been serving as the Deputy Incident Manager for our Ebola response planning here in the state of Oregon. So, what I'm going to walk you through is very briefly sort of the planning work that we've done. And what we've used this to present before the Health Policy Board, before state partners, between local public health, 911 operators, EMS. And what I want to communicate to you is that there really is a pre-October 1st and post-October 1st world. And what October 1st is that was the day when a individual who had Ebola walked into an emergency room in Dallas, and no one in the state, no one in local public health, and no one in the country knew that we had a potential Ebola patient who was in the state. That is not the case today. And so on October 31st, on Halloween, which is not that far from October 1st, things were much different when we had an individual who we were monitoring in the Portland metro area who spiked a temperature and became a person under investigation. And I'll walk you very briefly what we're calling the continuum of care roadmap. And so as a quick reminder, a person under monitoring is not ill, as Dr. Cieslak walked you through. A person under monitoring is just someone who has a level of risk based on that level of risk continuum that we've gotten from CDC. When someone develops symptoms that are consistent with Ebola, that's when they become a person under investigation, and that's what our continuum of care walks through. So the next slide. So also a framework, real quickly before I go through the continuum of care, is there's 3 levels of hospitals. And so every hospital in the state, and actually every hospital in the country, should be at this level 3 level that we have up here, which basically means that all hospitals should be prepared to hold on to anyone who is a potential Ebola patient for 24 hours, have appropriate protective information or protective equipment and training so that they can assess, isolate, and move the individual if needed. The level 2 hospital, which are the ones that we have 7 of here in Oregon, are the hospitals that would hold on to a patient for about 4 days as we wait for either a confirmatory or a non-confirmatory test for Ebola and are able to rule in or rule out the disease. And then the final level are the treatment hospitals. And last week, the CDC and HHS announced that there are 35 level 1 hospitals in the country. There's not one in Oregon currently. Many of us know about the treatment centers in Nebraska and Emory in Atlanta and the National Institutes of Health. They've added to those to build a more complete network. So next slide. So this is the continuum of care roadmap, and I'll walk through it very briefly. But the first level on this is something Dr. Cieslak referenced briefly earlier, is that when an individual goes through customs who's been to one of the affected regions, they get a specific interview, and they're given a packet if they're identified to have a level of risk. That packet has very specific information about what's going to happen when they return to the United States. It also has a thermometer, which has been approved by an FDA-approved thermometer that they will actually use during the process when local public health reaches out to them. So we actually get an alert from customs and the CDC quarantine and isolation station where we actually learn the identity, the risk level, and information about the individual who is now a person under monitoring. At the state, then we reach out to the affected county health department and we provide instructions and guidance on what should happen over the next 21 days. And at this point, really, the county local public health sort of becomes the guide for that person. So in a normal circumstance, if I were to become ill, I would go to my doctor. Or if I were to break my leg, I would call 911, for example. That's not necessarily going to be the case for a person under monitoring. In this case, the main contact is either the local health officer or the communicable disease nurse or whoever the contact is in that county who works one-on-one with that person. So they're not going to be calling 911 when they develop symptoms consistent with Ebola. They're going to be calling local public health. And this actually worked through on Halloween when we had the individual in the Portland metro area who developed symptoms. And this sort of worked out actually as planned. And so what local public health does is they call the person under monitoring, they remind them of the instructions that they got when they came through customs, they provide them information that if they're a low-risk individual that they're going to be contacting them twice daily to figure out what their temperature is. There's a temperature log, a thermometer log that they're supposed to be taking, and local public health will touch in and find out how the person's doing. Now, if they're a higher-risk individual, if they're at that some risk or high-risk risk level, then that might actually need to be a one-on-one, face-to-face interaction that public health does at that point. There might be travel restrictions that they're provided. So at this point, the person under monitoring and local public health have, they're starting to build this rapport and this relationship. Next slide. But if the person under monitoring develops symptoms, as I mentioned, the person under monitoring would then contact local public health. And then sort of things become less linear and there's a lot of different work that's happening. Local public health reaches out to the state public health department. Local public health is evaluating the individual on the ground. They're contacting the states, the hospitals that have been identified in the state, the hospital in their region that they would go to for that level 2 treatment. They begin to contact EMS because the person needs to be transported by EMS. And they also start contact tracing. And so that's sort of a core tenet of public health. That's how we know how many people that individual's been in contact with. And this is a strain point on the system. And so in the metro experience that we had on Halloween, we would have gone from having three or four persons under monitoring to about 35 or 40 persons under monitoring because of household contacts and healthcare workers and people who were involved with transporting the person from point A to point B. And we heard very loud and clear when we've communicated this with local public health that would have been a strain on our local public health system. The state would have been able to come in and provide a level of support. But there would have been a point that if we started talking about getting a couple of persons under monitoring who had temperatures, and we've got 80, 90 now persons under monitoring because of this person under investigations contacts, there's going to be a strain on our system, and it's going to be very difficult to track and maintain the level of oversight that we need around the persons under monitoring in the state. What also happens is that the state begins to convene calls with the Centers for Disease Control, the state laboratory, the CDC laboratory. CDC may be sending in a team at this point based on the level of risk that the individual has. And these calls are constant. That there were about 4 or 5 of these phone calls that happened in a 6-hour period on Halloween, where we were getting together laboratory people, we were getting together clinical people with the CDC, clinical people at the hospital in Providence, Milwaukee, with the clinical staff at CDC in Atlanta, and we were sort of playing that convener call. Next slide. And so what Also, we want to communicate to you is that plan A is that a person under investigation would move directly from their home in a best case scenario to that Ebola level 2 treatment center. So they would bypass the level 3 hospitals that would hold them for 24 hours. And the reason for this is there's no reason to add unnecessary touch points. Why add another 30 or 40 persons that are monitoring if we don't have to? We can get them directly to that that Ebola level 2 hospital. Now, what may happen is, you know, there's the 1 in a million scenarios. The individual is running to the phone to call local public health to tell them that they've spiked a temperature and they fall down the stairs and break their leg. Then they might need to go to a level 3 hospital, which would be any hospital in the state. And then they would be held for 24 hours, isolated. They would be prepared and then moved when it was appropriate for them to move to a level 2 hospital. Next slide. And so what happens is that those level 2 hospitals hold on to them for 96 hours while we get a confirmatory and non-confirmatory test. They provide care for the patient. And then if the individual tests positive, that's where the CDC would come in. They would send their rapid response team. They would evaluate everything from the hospital's willingness and ability to continue to prepare and treat the person through the course of their investigation, through the course of their illness. And if the individual needed to be transported, CDC would assist us in transport at that time. So, next slide. And these are sort of a whole host of questions we've gotten since October 1st when there was an individual in the state. What kind of travel advice is there? What kind of work restrictions are there? What happens with pets? Are there treatment hospitals? What precautions do healthcare workers need? How much PPE, personal protective information, do I need if I'm a 911 operator? What and how do we treat waste? What do we do with laboratory? Can our lab test? Can our lab not test? What do we do about malaria? Because malaria is endemic to this region as well. What do we do with sewage? We've got answers to all of these questions. That's a much larger slide set that I'm not going to walk you through today, but this is some of the work that public health's been doing over the past 5 to 6 weeks. So I'm going to turn briefly back over to Paul.
Okay, well, so... Ebola is one disease, but as the sage once said, it's always something. And over the past few years, if you could hit it, you'll probably recall diseases like pandemic influenza or bird flu or SARS or anthrax or even concerns about smallpox, West Nile virus, dengue, chikungunya come up, and we kind of go through this drill every time. Go ahead. This slide, excuse me, I need to look at my cheat sheet. This slide represents the assessment of state and local public health officials regarding what kind of hazards might we be facing, how likely are they to occur, and what kind of impact are they likely to have should they occur. And so they're plotted out in this scatter plot. Toward the right side of the slide, you see the events that are likely to have the major impact. And as you go up on the slide, we think the probability of their happening increases. So the gargantuan one that we have to fear is the Cascadia earthquake. There are some things that occur much more commonly, like heat events or landslides, flooding. Emerging diseases is where I live. I'm the communicable disease guy. But you should be aware that although we can set priorities in Oregon based on what we think is likely to occur, our funding comes from the federal government. I mean, all of my salary and 93% of my section's funding is federal. So sooner or later, it's the feds who get to determine what our priorities are.
Although I have to put a plug in right here, Mr. Chair. We are presenting to this legislative body in 2015 a modernization of public health, and hopefully the culture here in this body will change a little bit and view public health as it really should be. Just a comment.
Thank you, Senator. I think it's your turn.
And we're running pretty short on time today, so I don't know how much more of your presentation might be left. It's very fascinating. But we want to make sure we have plenty of time for everybody else as well.
Okay, we'll try to be brief.
Thank you, sir.
Chair Bocos, Matthews. I'm Rod Calkins. I'm the administrator over at the Marion County Health Department. And a few points I want to emphasize is that the health emergency preparedness response is really a system, both at the state and the local level, as well as the federal, as you've heard. local health departments. We deal with communicable disease in our community as part of our daily jobs. In emergency planning, we're working with our community partners and healthcare providers, hospitals, and our communities. And it's why it's important to plan for a health emergency is that everybody needs to know their roles, and by knowing our roles in advance, by doing those trainings that you saw, everybody knows what to do. We're better able to protect the community because we're better able to perform when an emergency does happen. I want to tell you a little bit about on the ground what we've done in terms of this response for Ebola at the local health department level. Early on, Marion County activated a partial incident command structure back in October. We've been participating in those what have been weekly calls for briefings and advisories and updates and monitoring the situation stat as it's developed. One of our principal responsibilities has been to send out advisory and make sure that healthcare providers in our community are informed about what's happening, as well as what recommendations, technical assistance is coming down from state public health and the national level. Throughout the state, there have been various exercises, tabletops, planning activities, seminars with local partners. Marion and Polk counties held a seminar, and we sat down with our healthcare providers in the region. We identified potential gaps, such as whether we all had enough personal protective equipment on hand. We discussed how the various participants are ready to respond in case we were to have a case of Ebola here in our community. And we developed a plan for how we were going to transport somebody who was ill. I think we've seen enough of this slide to kind of understand that different levels of the system have different roles and responsibility, but those roles and responsibilities are quite complementary as you go from the healthcare provider who may recognize a disease or potential disease in their office, be in contact with local public health, all the way up to the CDC. What I wanted to emphasize was that Oregon's public health emergency response system is really a statewide approach. All 34 local health departments are required to provide control of preventable disease on an ongoing basis. The actual form of how we do that may vary a bit from community to community, but it's guided by a common thread of knowledge and science about how we prevent disease, stop its transition, and respond effectively in emergency. Unfortunately, the federal funding has been reduced over the years, and an effective communicable disease response and emergency preparedness are really two key roles of state and local public health, and it's essential that that ongoing capacity be maintained across all areas in Oregon. Okay, I'd like to close with, when things look grim and disease gets dire, who are you going to call? The answer is public health, of course. We have a history of responding to urgent health care needs, and we're skilled collaborators with our community partners. And who else has every medical provider's fax number on their speed dial in your community? And finally, it is our job to protect the public. Thank you. I hope that was brief enough.
Thank you, sir. And thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Chair, any questions for the panel?
No, I just have one comment, and that is, having been there firsthand in the cholera outbreaks and having been in West Africa in these previously, one ounce of preparatory planning goes a long ways. The reason it's not been here before is, even as bad as the photos look over there, a little bit of preparatory planning over there has paid off in the past, and this time it just got out of control and arrived on your doorstep. And I think we all appreciate the hard work that the first responders, the hospitals, public health does, and it's
things we don't even know. So much now we look at these health departments and we forget that they even exist sometimes, except when an emergency comes up, and then we in the legislature and public officials go, well, why didn't you do this? And we appreciate the hard work you do.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Any questions for the panel? Representative Boone.
A quick one. And Dr. Calkins kind of answered it, that what Marion County's doing, but I kind of caught a hole in this trajectory. And what if somebody mentioned the fact, what if while you're on the phone you fall down the stairs because you're ill and you break your leg, so you call 911? And what if you're in rural Oregon and you have a volunteer fire department? Are those guys being trained? I know in our area they're not. They're hearing it, and they're hearing if you have a patient who does this and this and this, you call. But or if it's a car accident and you're on the highway, it's a high-speed crash, you've got people bleeding and everything like that, and one of them's a transferred patient, for example. Everybody gloves up and stuff, but they don't all use the big masks. And that's a hole, in my opinion, and I think they don't. They know that they watch what's going on, they hear these things, but they might have heard about the patient here, they're not going to come to Clatsop County or Tillamook County or whatever. But I'm just wondering, what are you doing to reach out to these all-volunteer departments who potentially could be at risk for handling somebody?
So we have liaisons on our incident management team who are working statewide with 911, fire, and other first responders on preparation. And what we're doing is, that's where local public health is playing the guide. And so we're working with counties so that if counties don't currently have a plan, that they would develop a plan. And also, one of the main sort of choke points that we've also found is transportation from rural areas. And so we've actually identified EMS providers of last resort who would be able to transport anyone from anywhere in the state to one of the 70 Ebola treatment, or I'm sorry, one of the 70 one of our level 2 Ebola treatment facilities. And so those are holes that we've been working through with our incident management team, and we've been working very closely with our local public health partners on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Baskerville, did you have?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tynan, you mentioned that if we had to monitor 50 people or so, and you had to have 80 or 100 people monitor this, it was a problem. And then you said the state may do this or the state may do that. What's your contingency plan in place in case the state does nothing to monitor these people? You said it'd be a problem.
Well, I think the challenge is that the state would be strained because of the, as Dr. Cieslak said, there's 97% of his funding is funded by the federal government. And so what would end up happening is that work would stop. Is that work, that long-term work on the other disease work, would stop, and we would have to focus all of our resources at the state level to support local public health. And so if there's a, I don't know, Paul, if you want to jump in here, but if there's other disease investigations that are going on related to chronic disease, related to some other disease that's not as dire or as urgent, that's the work that would stop, that would have to focus on sort of the monitoring. The answer of that there'd be 50 or 100 people under persons that are monitoring in Oregon and no one would be tracking them isn't an appropriate answer. And we'd also, if needed, reach out to our federal partners. We have CDC disease detectives who work in our division, who work in Paul's section, and we'd ask for support from the federal government if we needed to provide more disease detectives. That's what happened in Dallas. There were teams of disease detectives, teams of health communications individuals, and teams of policy experts who came in to assist the folks at the Texas and the Dallas Health Department during the incident that they had in early October. So this is where it is. This is truly a system approach. Is that if the local government's overwhelmed, then the state would come in to provide assistance where we could, and if we became overwhelmed, we'd reach to our federal partners.
I think the other thing I would add to that is at the local level, we all have mutual aid assistance agreements with communities that surround us. And fortunately, in this region, that extra help is close. So those folks could help us with the contact and monitoring as well. But it is an issue. If that were going on in several regions of the state, it would be quite overwhelming.
And this is where, you know, we wouldn't just rely, you know, we would pull people from across public health. So when an incident management team is developed, it's not just individuals with communicable disease or preparedness planning who go out and works. You'll have people from the tobacco program, people from the obesity program, people from injury prevention. And this is, by the way, a model that the CDC follows as well. It's not uncommon for that to be the scenario, that we sort of pull off of all of our resources within the public health system.
Great. Thank you for that. And members, we really have got to move on. We've got a packed agenda. Gentlemen, thank you very much. You talk about a 21-day incubation period for the Ebola virus, not to be confused with the 35-day special session with the legislature. Thank you. Symptoms do apply the same. Thank you.
And speaking of symptoms, if House members, if you just pause for about 90 seconds, I'm going to open a work session for purposes of measure introduction. A vote in favor of merely introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It's not indicative of members of opinion and position, and if any, or the content of the measure. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boquist, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC-1181, dated 12-1-14. LC-1515, dated 10-17-14. LC-1517, dated 9-22-14. LC-1520, dated 9-30-14. LC-1521, dated 9-30-14. LC-1522, dated 9-30-14. LC-1584, dated 10-21-14. LC-1599, dated 10-1-14. LC-1604, dated 11-24-14. LC-1893, dated 10-27-14. LC-2446, dated 12-1-14. LC-2697, dated 12-1-14. LC-1587, dated 11-19-14. And LC-1893, dated 10-27-14.
Senator Vice Chair Monica Anderson has introduced 14 legislative concepts as recited that they be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion on the Senate side? Seeing no discussion on the Senate side, if there's no further discussion, is there objections? If not, the 14 concepts are introduced as committee bills, and this closes the work session for the Senate. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. And thank you again for accommodating our members and getting some of those bills in there as well. So next up, we have the Oregon Resilience Task Force recommendations pursuant to Senate Bill 33 from 2013. Dr. Scott Ashford, Dr. Jeff Rubin, and Jay Wilson, please. And gentlemen, I know you have hours of information you'd like to share. So here's what we'll do for everybody out there and figure out how you want to divide your time the best. We will have about 20 minutes for each presentation. How you want to split the time for the presenters is up to you. We'd like to have a few questions or a few minutes for questions from the members as the panel. So with that, if you could, thanks for being here today and really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Scott Ashford. I'm the Kearney Professor and Dean of Engineering at Oregon State University. I also serve as chair of the Governor's Task Force in Implementation of the Oregon Resilience Plan.
Jeff Rubin, I'm the Emergency Manager for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and the Special Districts Association of Oregon representative on the task force, and I'm the vice chair.
And good morning, Representative Matthews, Senator Boquist. My name is Jay Wilson. I'm the chair of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, currently appointed as a Disaster Resilience Fellow with the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and I'm an emergency manager in Clackamas County.
What we're here today for is to outline our recommendations from this governor's task force on the Oregon Resilience Plan, which is really helping prepare Oregon for this Cascadia subduction zone earthquake that was actually mentioned by our public health officials in our previous presentation. We had many members on our task force. Many members are in the audience today. We also had Representative Boone, Senator Olson were also members on the task force. And I appreciate the work of the task force over this past year on really narrowing down really what were the most important steps to take forward in this next biennium. The reason that we're here is this Cascadia subduction zone. This is an earthquake fault zone that stretches from British Columbia down into Northern California and is capable of a magnitude 8.5 or 9 earthquake every few hundred years. The last one occurred about 315 years ago. This is a similar type of earthquake that we saw in Chile in 2010 and the devastating earthquake and tsunami in Japan in 2011. If you look at the state of Oregon, it will introduce strong shaking throughout western and central Oregon. The 3 to 5 minutes of strong shaking will be followed by a tsunami along the Oregon coast, potentially devastating some of our coastal communities. And this type of earthquake, the geographical extent of this type of earthquake is overwhelming. Where our neighboring states, where we often may be looking for help, we're also going to be affected. This is type of earthquake will be felt from Salt Lake City down to San Diego. This is a massive type of earthquake. There is much volunteer work done on the Oregon Resilience Plan that was led by OSPAC. This work looked at where we are today and where do we need to go to become resilient. And this really isn't work that we're going to do in the next year, but this is really looking at over the next 50 years, how can we position Oregon to bounce back after a devastating Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. Just an example from the report, if you look at our current state of affairs for the Willamette Valley, working with our utility providers and other members in the on the task force, we're estimating that electricity would be out in the valley for 1 to 3 months. Police and fire stations would be out of commission for 2 to 4 months. Our top priority highways would be out for 6 to 12 months. Healthcare facilities for 18 months. And water and wastewater facilities from a month to a year. This has a devastating impact on the economy and on our communities. So what does this look like? After the earthquake, many bridges will be damaged, affecting our ability to move around after the earthquake, to get rescue and relief supplies to the Oregon coast and elsewhere here in the Willamette Valley. We have an energy fuel hub in northwest Portland that is on liquefiable ground, and it's likely that we will lose our only source of liquid fuel coming into the state. So what that means then is that we'll have a severe shortage of liquid fuels like gasoline and diesel, and people will be standing in line trying to get some gas, right, to get around. Typically what we say is the gas that you have in your car on the day of the earthquake is the gas you're probably going to have for a few weeks. It also means that some of our critical facilities will be affected and damaged and inoperable after a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. And these are facilities that we all depend on for relief efforts as well as getting the economy and the communities going again after this event. It also means that we'll lose many of our water supplies. And it means that we'll be possibly standing in line, getting water so that we can, basically that the people can survive. This is critical to the state. And then we face this double whammy with a subduction zone event where we have the 3 to 5 minutes of strong shaking, and then we get the tsunami. And a tsunami tears apart communities and may take decades to recover. This is just a scene from the tsunami area in Japan. 3 years after the earthquake, it will probably take more than a decade to rebuild some of these communities. So what we're talking about then is how does Oregon prepare so that we can keep businesses in business after a Cascadia subduction zone event? And also, how do we prevent communities from falling apart after a massive earthquake that affects all of western and central Oregon, as well as our neighboring states, and as well as Canada? And I'll just point out that all of these photos that I've seen, that I've shown, are images from earthquakes around the Pacific Rim, all in countries that are much better prepared than we are here in Oregon. So when we talk about resilience, what I'd like to point out is that we will have a loss of service after an earthquake. Everyone will have a loss of service in any event. We can't prevent damage. And what we're looking for is how quickly can we bounce back. And if you look at countries at like Japan and Chile, and like many of the images that I just showed, they were able to bounce back, and in days, weeks, and months, they were able to get things back and running and get their communities restored. I visited Chile 3 years after their massive earthquake. I could almost not tell that they'd had the earthquake. That's resilience. In Oregon, we are stuck with a lot of legacy infrastructure that was built before we understood this earthquake risk. And what that means is we're less resilient. There'll be far greater damage here in Oregon, and it will take us much longer to get back to where our current services are, let alone trying to improve our services afterward. So our committee finished, our task force finished their work. We submitted a report to the legislature on October 1st, and we took over 140 recommendations from the Oregon Resilience Plan, and we narrowed it down to very specific recommendations in these eight areas that we believe are the most important to take steps on this biennium. It's going to take 50 years for us to become resilient, but we need that 50 years to start now with this upcoming biennium. And what I'll do now is I'll go through these eight areas and our specific recommendations, and I will tag team a little bit with my vice chair, Jeff Rubin. At the end of this, Jay Wilson, who's chair of OSPAC, will close up with his representing OSPAC and really where OSPAC sits on these recommendations. Our primary recommendation, and really the very first one, is that we need to appoint, and a resilience policy advisor needs to be appointed by and report directly to the governor. We have had several years now of volunteer efforts, and I think the time for that is over, and we need to have somebody in the state office, in the governor's office, that has oversight on this resilience preparation. We believe it's not something that needs can sit in a specific agency. It really needs to sit above the agencies in the governor's office. We had two recommendations around transportation. The first is that we identify additional revenue to complete the most critical backbone routes identified by ODOT's seismic options report. The construction on the backbones needs to start within the decade and be completed by 2060. The funding should be ongoing, as pay-as-you-go, not a bonding effort. And as part of this, we need research should be incorporated into that program to ensure that we're using the most current technology and efficient methods are applied for the specific case of a Cascadia subduction zone here in Oregon, as compared to what we've learned from the much shorter earthquakes that you might see down in California and the good work of Caltrans. We also recommend that the state conduct a thorough inventory and assessment of transit, air, water port, and rail assets in preparation for future investments. So to give you an idea of this backbone route, after a Cascadia event, the main north-south route through the state of Oregon is going to be Highway 97. The primary airport designated by the FAA is the Redmond Airport. And the initial phase one backbone route goes Highway 97 over to 84 through 205 and I-5 and over Highway 58 back over to 97. And this is just a core to try to ensure that we have some mobility around the state after a Cascadia subduction zone event. And much of that work would be done with our bridges that are shown here in the green triangles.
Our land use recommendations focus on the tsunami hazard. So the first one does not require legislative action. We recommend that the Dogami Governing Board adopt the L line. There are several tsunami hazard map scenarios, and the small, medium, large, extra large, XL, XXL. We recommend the L, which would move the line banning development a little bit landward. governing board has the authority to do that. In the meantime, and actually regardless of when or if that is done, we recommend that local governments not only adopt the latest version of the hazard maps, but that they do so based on what they feel is going to match their community best. If they feel a different scenario is required, so much the better. We encourage them to adopt stricter guidelines, and to facilitate that, we recommend funding approximately $5 million be made available, and that's based on approximately 20 cities deemed most at risk on the coast, with an estimated cost of about $250,000 per city to modify their comprehensive plans accordingly. And last but not least, revising the urban reserve rules so that we can facilitate both preparedness and recovery. The two components are, first of all, allowing for that pre-disaster designation of the urban growth boundary extension so that when we are developing, we're developing in safer ground rather than developing in what the current growth boundary may have, which is in an inundation zone. And the other component of that, facilitating recovery by allowing some type of rapid post-disaster urban growth boundary modification so that a community trying to recover from tsunami does not have to go through the typical lengthy process to do so.
Our energy recommendations, we have two. The first is that the Oregon Public Utility Commission require the energy providers that it regulates conduct seismic assessments of its regulated facilities. Coupled with that is that we allow cost recovery for prudent investments related to these assessments and mitigation efforts of the vulnerabilities identified during these assessments. So let's regulate the public utilities. They want this regulation under the PUC, not another agency, and they want a way to pay for the seismic upgrades that they're going to have to do to their systems. We did look at the liability concerns of the utilities, and Senator Boqvist brought that up, I think, at previous hearings. We did have the Department of Justice give an opinion on that. It was inconclusive, but I did give that opinion to the committee administrator for your use. Secondly, we need to establish a public-private partnership to mitigate and evaluate diversification of locations for storing liquid fuels and identification of a new liquid fuel energy corridors. This energy hub in Northwest Portland is extremely vulnerable to earthquakes, and it is our only source of liquid fuel coming into the state. Rather than mandating fixing that one single source, I think at this time we recommend the most prudent step is to find an alternative source elsewhere in the state so that we get a little bit of redundancy in the state. Secondly, that was secondly, and I think I'll turn it over to Jeff.
So this figure is from the Oregon Resilience Plan, but it shows the extreme age relative to current seismic codes for our K-12 schools, police and fire stations, and community colleges. The median age and the great majority were before we even had seismic building codes here, before we recognized we were a seismic hazard zone. So our critical facility recommendations amount to largely how we retrofit and what we can retrofit. We recommend funding Dogami with up to $20 million, the amount depending on exactly what Dogami is charged with, to do a far more detailed and enhanced statewide inventory for evaluating our critical facilities. For the Seismic Rehab Grant Program, SRGP, we recommend it be funded with an initial amount for this coming biennium of $200 million, and that we continue that in each subsequent biennium. I believe the original authorization was a total of $2 billion. We can't overemphasize that this has to be an initial commitment to an ongoing process and funding. The current SRGP regulations are fairly strict. Demolition costs for unsafe buildings can be a determining factor in whether a community can afford to retrofit, and we recommend broadening the definition of seismic rehab to include demolishing unsafe structures based on the unsafe nature based on the combination of construction and possibly location, for example, if they're in an inundation zone. In addition, we recommend modifying SRGP eligibility for facilities to allow dollars to be used towards replacing as opposed to simply retrofitting. And we understand that as the SRGP was established by constitutional amendment, that rather than trying to amend the Constitution on this, this may simply require establishing a partner program or parallel program to SRGP that would cover actual replacement and demolition as opposed to just retrofit. And last but not least, back to you.
Excuse me.
So for our research recommendations, we recommend that the state establish a research initiative that would provide $1 million annually in research funds aimed at improving Oregon's earthquake resilience. This is would be a matching fund similar to other matching research funds that we have here in the state. The funds would go to the state public universities for state, federal, and industry-funded earthquake research. These would be matching funds administered by and in collaboration with Dogami. This would be a partnership between Oregon's universities, industry, and agencies. And there's many many agencies as well as utilities that have stepped up in this process. Portland General Electric, Northwest Natural Gas, the Port of Portland, Eugene Water and Electric Board, Portland Water Bureau, ODOT, Bonneville Power Administration, Tualatin Valley Water District, all have begun funding research aimed at mitigating their earthquake hazard. And as we get into this next 50 years, the state of Oregon will be, and the businesses in the state, the people of the state, will be investing large sums of money in earthquake readiness. And I think it's important that the research that is aimed at making value and cost-informed decisions. At this time, we do not recommend that a formal center of excellence for resiliency be established. I think at this point, it's really all the universities need engage with the agencies on this research effort.
So we looked at oversight and research and infrastructure. All those are to protect the people. This deals with the people themselves, our training and education recommendations. For starters, funding OEM at $500,000 for the upcoming biennium to develop and disseminate educational materials. This would be for agencies, response agencies and others, businesses and the general public. The most important component of that would be taking an ORP recommendation to really push the concept of at least 2 weeks preparedness as opposed to 72 hours. When you're talking about major earthquakes, 72-hour kits went out with short pants. It's just, it's not a realistic objective, and it's not going to be sufficient. In addition to that particular focus, we believe it's worthwhile to develop the full spectrum of training and education, disaster preparedness, response, recovery, as well as mitigation. And while we're educating the public, we also want to provide development for the people responsible for implementing this, emergency managers, as well as policymakers and decision makers, establishing electronic clearinghouse for supporting information and references. Department of Education also being funding to establish standardized curriculum rather than one district at a time for basic education related to preparedness in general and seismic resilience in particular in K-12. That we believe that's the best way to build a culture of resilience as we move forward, and we are looking at the long term. And last but not least, OEM and Biz Oregon partnering on developing community continuity assessment and planning resources for businesses so that we can maintain economic strength. The last piece of this is water and wastewater. Most we think about it when we turn on and off a faucet, but the first two bullets recommend that both water and wastewater agencies complete detailed seismic risk assessments and mitigation plans as part of their required periodic updates for their facility plans. And the last piece was rather than make a specific recommendation or mandate that all water providers either install seismic cutoffs in their reservoirs or don't, that the water purveyors, firefighting agencies, and emergency managers within communities establish their own joint standards, whether it's seismic cutoffs or not, so that everyone has common priorities and common expectations.
Thank you. And Jay, they have not left you much time, but I'm going to...
I've got about 5 minutes.
Can you make it 3.5?
I can. I've only got about 3 or 4 slides. Thank you.
Thank you,
good morning. Thinking global and acting local, there are a lot of examples of resilience out there that we can learn from. I want to emphasize that OSPEC's role as the author of the resilience plan is going to continue after this task force, and primarily we're working with the governor and the legislature's office. Next slide. But that we intend to fully support a resilience policy advisor's role if we have one appointed, and to continue our efforts in working with the legislature over the next 25 biennium and bring this down to the local level and connect this with the National Disaster Resilience Framework. And what I want to emphasize, that this framework, which I'm a part of, is part of the President's Climate Action Plan, looking at greater approaches to resilience from a national level. And the Oregon Resilience Plan is one of the key plans that are referenced. Next slide. But the big takeaway from me from my first meeting is this identification of planning for the expected disaster. And the City of San Francisco's reference here is what's going into the national framework. Next slide. And if you scroll down, you can hit the cursor, Scott, to advance it just for emphasis one more time. That in earthquakes, they're looking at 500-year return intervals as the expected earthquake to plan for. Next slide. And in Oregon and in the Northwest, the 500-year return interval is Cascadia. It's our expected earthquake. It's not this far-flung giant thing that's way out there. It's the one that actually should be the basis for everything we're planning for earthquakes in the state. And this was an eye-opener for me, and it's an emphasis that this is much more salient than being abstract in the way that it's been for the last 20 years. Next slide. And so in pursuing resilience, and especially with some of our recommendations, we have to update our administrative rules, our statutes, in a timely fashion based on best available science so that our local communities have these as tools and guidances to do the work that's needed and make informed decisions and not fall through the cracks. And I'm using this example with this newly proposed hospital in Gold Beach that is going in and didn't have the benefit of having the updated Dogami maps as the basis for their decision making and the rules that would apply to them. It's the kind of missed opportunity that we can't afford to let happen again here in the state. Next slide. And so the issue is lessons from a global perspective of demonstrated resilience. I recently in September visited this hospital in Ishinomaki that is base isolated. You can see the isolators in their foundation. It was built a few years before the earthquake and it survived the earthquake. It was operational during and after the earthquake and continued to provide services throughout for the community. Next slide. Another example for a critical facility is a fire station in that same prefecture, built with base isolation well in advance, and it continued to operate. And this is exactly the kind of design criteria for our expected earthquake that we need to be doing on the front end so that our critical facilities are continuing to operate and not only serve the immediate communities, but to be there throughout, and what brings in the resilience dividend of the investment at a community scale. And so my closing slide is just to emphasize the role that OSPEC has here in this state to be here to reduce exposure to earthquake hazards. Thank you.
Phenomenal job, and OSPEC, great job as the chair of the group. And this resilience plan is really, I'm glad to see that you were able to pare it down a little bit to the understandable 8 items from the 140 initially, because it's overwhelming from our perspective on what we need to be doing next. But certainly choosing action over inaction is important. Let me make sure, Chair. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen and Dr. Ashford in particular, you spent a great deal of time talking about resilience and, I think, access post-event to fuels. I'm concerned possibly about resilience in terms of potential release of fuels or energy sources and potential harm to humans as well as the general environment. I'm talking about liquid fuel storage and tank farms I'm talking about potential gasified fuels, including a site that's trying to be permitted in Astoria for LNG that would be located on a sand spit, first subject to liquefaction followed by tsunami. I'm concerned about dams around the state, and I'm also concerned about potential release from spent nuclear fuel. Do we have sites that pose problems to the public in Oregon?
Yes.
You know, the where we are in the state of Oregon with much of our legacy infrastructure, you know, most of what we have here in Oregon, the many of the buildings, the pipelines, the wires, the facilities, were built before we even knew of this risk. And so there are many facilities around the state that are quite vulnerable to a magnitude 9 earthquake off the Oregon coast. And that's 3 to 5 minutes of shaking. And if you look at the Oregon coast, you know, we have the ability to design for these events. And I think the biggest threat to Oregon is the fact that we have so much infrastructure that was built before we even recognized, you know, the Cascadia's existence.
Thank you. Any further comments? Wonderful. Thanks for the work. I'm sure the legislative session will be hearing a lot from you in the next 6 months. Thank you so much. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
And next up, if we could, the PTSD study, Kaiser Permanente, with Lori Satinspiel and Dr. Carla Green. Good morning, ladies. Thank you for your patience. Whenever you're ready, we're ready for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori Satinspiel here as part of my private life, the board chair for the Joys of Living Assistance Dogs. Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, we're excited to be here again and all the committee. In 13, we were before you. We talked about veterans and post-traumatic stress and the impact that we thought dogs had on folks and their ability to regain what they can for an independent life. I do apologize. We've only got one dog to share with you today. We had a graduation in November of 10 dogs. I believe 8 went to veterans, so we're a little low on dogs, which is a good thing for us. But I was excited that after our work in 13, that we hooked up with Kaiser Permanente on their research of post-traumatic stress and to try to help the federal level see that dogs do help. So I wanted to bring them here today to talk about what's going on with the research project, and just as it's of time, we'll move right into Carla and let her introduce herself.
Great, thank you. Welcome.
Chair Matthews and Chair Boquist and members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting us today. My name is Carla Green. I'm a social psychologist and senior investigator at the Kaiser Permanente Center for Health Research in Portland. This is my colleague, Bobby Jo Yarbo. She is a psychologist, clinical psychologist, also working on the team. And we are here to give you some preliminary results from a study that we've been working on that we call the PAWS pilot study. Go ahead. We have a team of members here in Oregon, including Joys of Living Assistance Dogs and Joy St. Peter, also PAVE in Forest Grove. And we have collaborators also at Kaiser Permanente, Georgia. So we put together a group of researchers and community partners to try and get, basically collect enough data to be able to at least draw some preliminary conclusions about whether or not these dogs are effective. In terms of background, you may know this, being the Veterans Committee, as many as 42% of reserve soldiers have diagnosable mental health conditions, as do 20% of active soldiers and 25% of veterans. We all know this is a huge public health problem. 56% of veterans that return with mental health conditions have more than one psychiatric diagnosis. So the burden of illness is significant. in these people. And we know that the suicide rates are very high for this very reason. Community reintegration problems are common, particularly for those with psychiatric disabilities. Younger veterans are at greater risk than older veterans for psychiatric problems. And the stigma associated with mental health problems in the military can cause barriers, important barriers, to care seeking. And, go ahead. One of the reasons we're interested in these dogs is this is an alternative form of mental health treatment that may be acceptable to many veterans who would not accept other forms of mental health treatment. So we know that there's a long history of the use of service dogs for physical disabilities. We have many anecdotal reports about their value for psychiatric disabilities and for general entertainment. But there is no systematic evidence about their use for people with psychiatric problems, despite increasing interest in the dogs and increased anecdotal reports. So, one of the interesting aspects of this as well is that the anecdotal reports suggest that there may be ability to reduce psychiatric medications and other medications among veterans who have service dogs. If that's the case, that has great potential for a number of really important things. One, psychiatric medications often have a variety of negative side effects that cause people to quit taking them, which leads to far worse outcomes, as you might imagine. So if we can substitute something like a dog for psychiatric medications, we're already ahead of the game. Also, psychiatric medications, many of them are extremely expensive. So there are real cost benefits to this if this is an effective treatment. Okay, so our goals for this study. We're to begin to understand and document the ways that service dogs aid veterans with PTSD, or also to identify problems. You know, it's not just a wonderful thing. You have to get used to living with a dog. You have to learn to train a dog. You have to deal with dog problems. You have to deal with a little barky in the room when the dog isn't supposed to bark. There are benefits, but there are also adjustments. So we wanted to document those. Our study design has been, we didn't have enough evidence to propose a randomized controlled trial. That will actually be the next step. So what we've done was identified people on waiting lists for service dogs and people who had already received dogs. And then as part of this study, we will have placed 21 dogs with veterans with PTSD and surveyed them and interviewed them before and after they received their dogs. And then we're also shadowing people and observing them to try and document the ways the dogs help them. And we've observed the training camps where veterans learn how to interact with their dogs, how to manage their dogs, learn to go into public. So far, we have 75 veterans who have participated, which is far more than, it is wonderful to have this many people at this stage. We were surprised and very pleased. 31% of them are women, average age about 43. So we have completed surveys with all these people and interviews with many. And as part of our work, we discovered very quickly that caregivers, as you might not be surprised, are extremely involved, and then they are also affected by the service dogs. So we got permission to interview an additional 10 caregivers of the people who received dogs as part of the study, and we have 3 of those interviews complete. So I have a little bit of that. Those data. So I want to start with some qualitative data, give you some examples from the interviews. First off, to give you an idea of what people are looking for. These are people on the wait list who are hoping for a dog. And just having a companion, someone that you can count on to be with you, would take down that wall of constantly being aware and afraid. So quality of life. We're talking about being able to do the simple tasks of life again, just being able to live again. right now, you know, sitting at home waiting for my husband to come home so I could feel okay to go somewhere is not really living. And some expectations about the way that ways that dogs may help these kinds of problems. And no matter how bad you're feeling or how ugly you feel or how angry that you feel, a service animal is going to be there no matter what. It's not judging me. I can sit here and I can blame myself. Why did you let all these bad things happen? But the animal doesn't care about that. They care about how you are here and now and having the ability to make you feel secure in who you are and what you're doing. And what you're doing out in the world is one of the most important things of life, you know. My own vision of who I am is so skewed by the past, but the animal doesn't see that. And here's an example of the need. I don't leave my house anymore, and if I do go somewhere, you won't find my wife, but maybe 4 or 5 steps away from me. I go nowhere without my wife. I don't do nothing by myself. A dog will give me my independence back, but it'll also give my wife her independence back. Other needs. I've heard from other veterans is they'll wake you up during a nightmare. My nightmares will get so bad that she'll wife have to leave. I need the dog to wake me up before that dream gets to the point where I wake up and I think I'm being shot at. That's going to help. And there's a thing I do, and this is a different participant. Perimeter checks. I have to know the house is secured. So 15 times a day, either him and I doing it together or him doing it alone would be huge relief on my brain that he could know if somebody's at the door or near a window because of their dog sense. So that reduction in constant anxiety. Mm-hmm. And here's an example of someone with a dog. He picks up on negative emotion and pulls me back out of that, back into the present. If I'm even in a down mood, he acts silly. I feel better going out in public now with him. I never went out for probably 3 or 4 years before my dog. I didn't go anywhere. It's not just emotional or in my mind. It's had a physiological effect on me. They finally took me off blood pressure medication because my blood pressure is down far enough. And I have a meaningful relationship with somebody now. This is, again, another participant. But I hadn't for such a long time that I couldn't remember what it meant. And then there was this dog with me 24/7 who never judged me based on how I felt. And he always knew what to do when I was feeling down. My wife says she got her husband back. She said that we will never, ever be without a service dog again. So these caregivers are really experiencing as many benefits as the veterans. Very interesting. Okay, other examples of people with dogs. I have not been in a full-fledged nightmare for more than 15 minutes because of him, because he puts his wet nose on my neck, and then if I start to thrash, he literally gets on the bed with me and wakes me up. I got off 2 of the psychiatric medications I was on. He does the patrol at night, watches the kids, so I'm not checking the windows and doors 50 times a night, maybe 5. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, I don't wake up instantly thinking, oh, the door is unlocked. And I think people are more acceptable of my behavior because of him. So social integration, ability to go out into the community, comfort and reduced anxiety at home and outside the home. So we also have some preliminary quantitative data. And these are comparisons of veterans with and without dogs. Now, we've done some statistical tests, but again, these people were not randomly assigned to these groups, so that these results are indicative of an effect of the dogs, but we don't know for sure that the dogs are causing these differences. What I can tell you is that people, veterans with service dogs, have fewer PTSD symptoms. They have better depression-related functioning, in other words, lower symptoms. Their interpersonal relationships are statistically significantly better. They have less substance abuse, and their overall mental health is better. They report fewer psychiatric symptoms. In comparison, there are no differences on combat exposure, so that is a good thing. You would expect people with similar combat exposure would have similar traumatic outcomes. So to see these differences between the two groups on mental health symptoms suggests that, in fact, even though they have similar combat experiences, the dogs may be helping. And we found no differences in self-reported physical health. So what we see is dogs that are targeting mental health and a difference in terms of mental health, but no difference in terms of physical health. Again, that's more indication that, in fact, these dogs are truly helping with PTSD symptoms. And that's all we have for you today.
Wonderful. And thank you for being here, and thanks for your participation in the study. We've seen the dogs now a couple different times coming in here. And, Lori, thanks for your great work outside of your lobbying abilities, getting a part of this and donating your time. Very valuable. So, Chair, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I've had, you know, the service dog is some way we need to identify the legitimacy of the service dog. I'm getting many complaints from restaurants and grocery stores of people taking their pet dog, which, you know, we all love our pets, but not everyone wants them around their food, that they're going into places of restaurants like where human food is being used for consumption. And we need to stop and figure out some way to make it designate some way where that's a certification on that dog. And this little jacketed thing, you can buy one of those, and people are putting them on their dogs and taking them into restaurants and grocery stores. And that's inappropriate. No one objects to a service dog, but people do object to having somebody's pet there. Especially, and I'll be honest with you, what I saw was unbelievable. I saw a lady going through a salad bar with a dog in her purse.
In her purse?
In her purse. So that's, I mean, unbelievable. But anyway, I'm going to work on that. Lori, maybe you can help me with it, because we need to figure out some way, and I'm thinking of maybe a county licensing with a certification where you get a special tag with the dog, something like that.
Chair Matthews, Chair Boquist, Representative Esquivel, we hear about this all the time. I know when I was puppy raising, when I went in someplace, they gave me that look, but they didn't know what to do. It's an education process part of it, because there is a piece of the law that says you can ask what they're either being trained for or what they're assisting with. And it's, you know, that's a piece of it is education, and that will help some. But I'll be happy to help you and assist you with what we can do. We've looked into that before.
Follow up?
Sure.
The problem there, Lori, is that they tell them what it is, but they don't have to demonstrate.
Correct.
Thank you. And with that, yeah, there. And I know that that was an issue before the legislature. Before, we had the grocery industries coming forward. Some folks have service iguanas. Some folks have service snakes. They are their companions. I personally have a honey badger, but I leave him at home, and he doesn't care.
Surprised you don't have a Burmese.
I appreciate
python.
All your great work.
Because I have a wife. Same
thing. Oh, that
doesn't
mean.
See, mine's on the record, but I'm not coming back.
Well, he's better.
Thank you very much for all you've done. And have a great day and continue the great work. We look forward to seeing what happens with this great program. Thank you for all you're doing. And we didn't get the dog's name.
You were?
Molly. Molly? We'll start calling Molly and driving nuts in here. Thank you so much. Next up, if we could please have from Portland Metro Veterans Connection, Patty J. and Lynn Jones, please.
Hi. Good. Thank you very much.
Are you solo today?
I am solo and was unable to make it. So
okay.
This won't take 20 minutes, I promise. Chair Matthews, Chair Boquist, respected committee members, thank you so much. My name is Patty J. I'm a program director for an amazing, it is a great segue, a great follow from the dog presentation, because again, Portland Metro Veterans Connection is pretty kind of a basic human need that we fill. As in the dogs that fill that need, that lack of isolation or lessening that, we provide a human connection with other veterans in the Portland metro area. I was raised by a World War II Marine. A lot of parties in my house were actually just GI parties. I was Oregon Air National Guard, or aerospace medical technician, 1979, 1986. So I have a little bit of knowledge of what it means to go through boot camp, to understand the military culture, some of the language. And that's what we bring to the program we're presenting and furthering, is bringing some of the veterans and the active duty and guard and recently returned veterans and military service members to a group. And the structure is on peer support. And I think you've probably heard of peers. It's gotten a lot of movement, a lot of legs, the peer movement from the state, mental health and addictions, the ODVA. We have conversations all over seeing the significance and the importance of putting people that understand this language, this culture, together. We provide meetups, social and service. We've gone to Winterhawks game. We're going to the Rose City Rollers Saturday night. We've done service. We've raked leaves at the Vietnam Memorial Wall. We're doing Christmas cards for the veterans home in the Dalles. So we provide a lot of not just good times, but heart-to-heart conversations. Our moving forward in 2015, we're going to be doing some military peer support training. It's being done big time in the East Coast, West Haven, Connecticut. There's a gentleman named Mo Armstrong who developed a program called Vet to Vet, and I've spoken with Mo. He's an incredible guy. Check him on Facebook. He's remarkable. And he sees the significance. He's been working in this for many, many years. We want to bring that here to Oregon. It takes, you know, instead of handing a veteran a fish, teaching him to fish. And I know that's an old adage, but I think it really makes a lot of sense to spread the commonalities that we have. The other part of it is to educate our communities what military structure, life, language, culture is about. But also I think the main thing I want to leave today is that the veterans, the military service members, we're people. We're just a matter of the community. We have different jobs that we've done. We've had different instructions and some very tough duties that we've had to fulfill these missions. But we are fathers, we're mothers, we're daughters, we're children, we're soccer coaches, we're musicians. We are people in this community, and I think the more that we can bring each other together, the better we are going to be in that transition. Whether it's been 30 years that you've been trying to transition into your community, or it was just last month when you got back, that's what matters. And respect the uniform, but get to know the person inside that uniform. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Before you leave, make sure we don't have any questions. Stay, if you don't mind standing by.
No.
Sure. Just thank you for your presentation.
You're welcome. Thank you, sir.
Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Patty. I just wondered if you have a template that you use, or do you know of other programs in other areas of the state where they could replicate your program?
Actually, thank you for asking that question, Representative Boone. Our template, actually, we're gleaning information. There's actually a state program of training that we're going to be working with. She's actually at the Oregon State Hospital. Fumi Nishimoto, she works with the state. Also gleaning also from the Portland VA, they have a peer training. So we're actually trying not to kind of recreate the wheel. There is peer training. It's very minimal in Oregon. It's mainly in Southern Oregon. Roseburg gets a lot of training. However, in this area, we're not seeing a lot of that. So we want to kind of take what is actually in use right now and just spread it, and be able to take the people that are coming to our program. So one thing to also mention, that I have a women-only vet group that we meet monthly. Some gals want to call each other the warriors, but it's remarkable. We have women vets that are from the military helpline, from the American Legion. We have vets from all over the community, seasoned veterans that are coming, and women that are coming forth and trusting us and telling about their stories of military sexual trauma. And coming out of the woodwork, so to speak. One by one, we're gaining numbers. We have about 15 women now that are coming together and really seeing the validity of this program. So our template basically is in the formation stage and development, but it is really, we're getting the people that kind of make the decisions and that have the knowledge. We want to come together collaboratively as a team. And I appreciate the time I've spent in legislative conversations, and I really feel that we're in a good place. It's a good time to get to know the people. There's a lot of programs out there that do basic needs. The one thing I've found, that peer support is one part that we can play.
Okay. Just a quick follow-up.
Yes.
Just to ask you if you do reach a point where you could share your progress with us and during the next session, for example, before July. If it's going to be after July, we're into the interim section, but maybe we could have an update at some point in the future.
Absolutely. We're starting to do tracking now and really track our numbers. We have a meetup page right now that does some tracking and numbers. We have about 63 people on our meetup. Some come, some are still navigating life to make this. It's kind of a new thing to come together and decide, I'm going to come out on a Wednesday night when it's cold and dark and to meet with other vets, but some people are seeing the significance. And I have women that have had suicide attempts, domestic violence in their relationships, and because of our group, and we recently come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, because of our group now, they've gotten out of that bad marriage, they're going back to school, they're really seeing the light and the hope that being together. And our women are very passionate about the women vets. And I'm very excited. So, yes, I will follow up with some numbers for you, definitely. Thank you.
Thank you for that, and thank you for your service. You were also a aerospace tech in the Oregon Air National Guard,
yes, 79
sir. To 86. Thank
yes.
you very much for your service.
You're welcome.
Have a great
thank
day.
You. Have a great day.
And if we could please, next up we have our informational meeting on service member, family member, and veteran support programs in Oregon. We have our esteemed Major General Daniel Hokanson, Adjutant General. Good to see you this morning, sir.
Yes, sir.
And I believe, is Cameron Smith going to join you, or is he going to stay in the back?
Yes, sir. He'll join us right at the very end.
Wonderful, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Before we start, I'd like to say a couple things before we get into this next issue. One is that we're progressing. I don't know that it was mentioned about the Vietnam Wall. We are doing a permanent Vietnam Wall in Medford. And it will be the only one on the West Coast, and the closest one is Oklahoma. And so we're doing a fund drive on that. The other thing is I want to thank Comfort Inn Suites because they've just given me, believe it or not, a complete case of their little soaps, their little shampoos, and toothbrushes that we're sending to our troops in the battlefields in Afghanistan and sending those over. We send over 500 at least every year to those troops.
Wow. That's great.
That's cool.
Well, thanks to them.
Very cool.
Thank you for that. Yes, sir.
Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, members of the committee, for the record, as mentioned, I'm Dan Hokanson, the Adjutant General for Oregon and the Director of the Oregon Military Department. With me today is Chaplain Terry Larkin. He's a Director of our Service Member and Family Support Programs, and Michelle Kachowski, who's his deputy, and also our State Family Program Director. At the conclusion of our presentation, as mentioned, Mr. Cameron Smith from Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs will join us. We're here today to provide a brief update on the service member and family support programs the Oregon National Guard provides to our service members and their families. As you see from the first slide, I'd like to start this presentation, like all of ours, by first introducing you to two of our service members. On the left is Staff Sergeant Stephen Tessitore, a squad leader in Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, based out of Corvallis, Oregon. And to his right is Specialist Michael Mangan from 1st Squadron, 82nd Cavalry, based out of Bend, both soldiers currently deployed. Although Stephen Tessitore had previously deployed multiple times, he insisted on deploying, in his own words, to be with and take care of the soldiers he had trained. In late November, he and his squad were wrapping up a patrol in downtown Kabul when a lone gunman pulled a weapon from underneath his scarf and at point-blank range shot Stephen three times in the neck and chest. Although seriously wounded, the soldiers he trained did exactly what Stephen had taught them. One immediately dispatched the gunman, and the actions of his medics saved Stephen from his potentially fatal wounds. I met Staff Sergeant Tessitore and his parents at Walter Reed National Medical Center the night he arrived in the United States. Although he still could not speak, his dry sense of humor came through when he wrote on his notepad, "They say my voice will change after surgery. Can they change it to Clint Eastwood?" Stephen has recovered very well so far, and he and his mother now are in San Antonio, where he will undergo numerous surgeries and rehabilitation until he's ready to come home to Oregon. When he returns to Oregon, we will conduct his official Purple Heart ceremony, as he was unconscious when they pinned it to him in theater. To his right is Specialist Michael Mangan. I met him in early November on a visit to Afghanistan, shortly after he was intentionally run over at a checkpoint outside of his base near Shindan, Afghanistan. While manning his checkpoint, the driver of a flatbed truck spread through the checkpoint and intentionally left the road to run over both Specialist Mangan and two other soldiers that were near him. The two other soldiers fortunately were able to jump out of the way, but Michael was struck head-on and went completely under the truck. Fortunately, he was wearing all of his protective gear, which likely saved his life and greatly reduced his injuries. Michael was medevaced to the U.S. despite his desire and intent to stay with his unit and is now undergoing physical therapy near his home in Bend while doctors determine if he'll need surgery on his knee and shoulder. As for the truck driver, he clearly did not realize Michael was part of a larger patrol, and their heavily armed MRAP and the rest of his Oregon team were a mere 100 yards down the road. The soldiers who avoided the truck alerted them, and they were waiting for him. I'll just leave it at that. Stephen and Michael are just two of 1,027 Oregon National Guardsmen and women currently serving overseas in support of U.S. combat operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Kuwait. For those 1,027 deployed soldiers and airmen, those here at home, and those who have previously served, I cannot stress enough the importance and value of our service member and family support programs. At this time, I'll hand it over to Chaplain Terry Larkin and Ms. Michelle Kachowski, who will provide a brief overview of our service member and family support programs.
Terry. Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, committee members, the Oregon National Guard provides services and support not only to Oregon National Guard service members, but to all service members in the state and to their families. We have 10 family assistance specialists and 4 family readiness support assistants whose role is to connect service and family members' needs with available resources and to work with and to train family volunteers. We have 3 child and youth staff who provide resiliency and leadership training for our military children and community outreach. Starting the 1st of January, we will have 4 transition assistance specialists to work with our returning veterans to be able to assist them in finding employment and educational guidance. We have 4 full-time behavioral health staff, 5 part-time behavioral health staff, and 17 part-time chaplains to meet the behavioral and spiritual needs of our service members. Every returning National Guard member of the over 1,000 that we have and family members are provided a wide range of resources and are invited to attend the Yellow Ribbon events for service members before and after they go downrange, and for family members in particular while their service loved ones are downrange. However, as with much of the government, we're in a constricting environment of federal budgets, and we're learning to sustain these essential services with less finances. And we're doing this in 2 ways. First, we're beginning to deliver our services more and more through joint programs, instead of having duplicate and sometimes redundant Army and Air National Guard programs. So this provides a synchronization of our efforts, a synergy, and a greater responsiveness to our service and family members. This also provides greater efficiencies when it comes to the manpower. Instead of having duplicate, sometimes redundant programs, we can consolidate them. And then second, we're also emphasizing the need to build partnerships with other agencies and organizations and individuals who are also interested in taking care of our veterans and their families. This includes our Federal Veterans Administration, as you hear about in a few moments, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, various state and county agencies, and a host of nonprofit and faith-based organizations. One example of how we're doing this is with our brand new Community Health Promotion Council in the Oregon National Guard. This new council has the goal to promote healthy living among our service members and their families by helping them tap into the abundant resources that already exists in our many communities. In short, our future is bright, We have some amazingly resilient service members and family members, like the Adjutant General talked about with Staff Sergeant Tessitore and Specialist Mangan. Yes, our federal budget is constricting, and we may need to approach the state legislature in the future for some assistance to be able to sustain these essential services. But our commitment to provide these essential services to our Oregon National Guard service members and their families remains unwavering. And you hear about that in just a few moments with our partnership that we stand side by side with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Sir?
Thank you.
Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, members of the committee, as Terry mentioned, although we expect a decrease in federal funding, we will continue to leverage it wherever we can and use it whenever possible to establish enduring service member and family support programs. The key to our success is going to be in resourcing our most successful programs for the long term, hiring the most qualified employees wherever we can, and working with other state agencies such as ODVA to provide the best service we can to our service members and their families. This concludes our portion of the testimony. I'd be happy to take questions now, or I can wait until after the presentation by ODVA and Mr. Cameron Smith.
Whatever you prefer. Is Cameron Smith ready? Come forward, sir, if you would.
Good morning, Chair Matthews, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, and I do not have any doom and gloom here this morning. I do not have any puppies, and I don't even have a snappy dress blue uniform, but I will try to get through this and maintain your attention.
But you have cute socks.
I want to thank General Hokanson, his wife Kelly, and his team with the Oregon Military Department, from Chaplain Larkin and Michelle to Colonel Ferrey in the back. Their leadership, both at that statewide level, community by community, and again at the national level, advocating for our military, our veterans, and their families, is a powerful partnership. But as we've heard, we are at a turning point, not just in the wars and conflicts overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan and in the Middle East and around the world, but also in a turning point in our work for our military, our veterans, and their families. We've been heavily dependent in Oregon on the Oregon National Guard and the military department for their leadership in the reintegration efforts, but that is beginning to tighten up with some of the federal funds. I'm going to blast through a few slides on kind of the veterans landscape and on our strategic framework that guides both our current resource allocation, how we're driving limited funds already, but also how it's shaping our governor's budget requests going forward. And then I'll give you a short highlight, given the big governor's budget book, on some of those investments. So we are calling this a new cadence. We are building on the strengths of where we have been, and then course correcting where appropriate to leverage assets. Ooh. There we go. So next year will be the 70th anniversary of ODVA, having stood up after World War II, but unprecedented that we are serving four generations across five major wars. One out of every 10 Oregonians is a veteran, over 320,000 across this state. And what's unique over the last decade is that almost 38% of those who have most recently deployed, 31,000 Oregonians, have deployed, often multiple times, but unique in this last, for this most recent generation, that 38% have been Oregon National Guard and Reserve components compared to the active military. These are our breakouts of our four generations from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, still 37% of our veterans population at the largest chunk. Peacetime, a quarter of our vets, often with a lot of service both overseas and at home, though. The Gulf War at 15%, and the most recent generation at 6.6%. And obviously, across all generations, a lot of issues across healthcare, mental health, education, housing, emergency services, disability compensation, just a breadth, the diversity of our population, both across the ages, 9% are women veterans, 8% minority, 1% tribal, but then with those broad policy areas that we want to drive forward. This is the system that delivers veterans benefits for ourselves, or this slide represents that. It's the veterans on the ground, county by county, going to their county veteran service office, having that county VSO take on a power of attorney and help them navigate what is a challenging bureaucracy at the federal level and the federal VA. It comes, you know, the State Department of Veterans Affairs has a huge training component of our county veteran service officers. We review the claims. We often do the appellate work on the appeals. But it is that partnership across the county and state system that then presents those claims to the federal VA for a decision, a rating decision on a disability benefit. Just a huge federal VA impact in terms of the economic impact coming back down to Oregon. $2.2 billion total of federal VA impact, somewhat incomprehensible, but $1.1 billion of that, half of those resources, is just cold hard cash of compensation and pension payments going into the bank accounts and wallets of our veterans. The other biggest chunk, almost $1 billion in health care benefits, both through the medical centers and the clinics, and then $128 million in terms of GI Bill and Voc Rehab benefits. If we look back, the red is 2003 dollars, the blue is the current for 2013. It has doubled over the last 10 years in terms of federal VA impact flowing back down into Oregon and helping preserve general fund state resources, safety net resources, both at the county and state level. Beyond that, that inverted pyramid of the federal VA, the state, and the county system, it is the sea of goodwill that exists that Chaplain Larkin talked about, the broader public-private partnerships, not always that it's a GARD or an ODVA program that is delivering the veterans benefits, but it's our leadership, our advocacy, and the strong partnerships to mobilize what are broad resources, both across state agencies, local governments, and then the true public-private partnerships. So here is the high-level five-year goals. Targeting veteran services, that is maximizing that federal VA dollars and preserving state general fund resources. Even beyond, it's that mobilizing of partnerships that gets that sea of goodwill. For driving veteran engagement, often it's not a lack of resources for our military and our veterans and their families, but simply making sure that who are our veterans, what are the resources, and making sure they are connected. And then making sure that we invigorate our own core operations at the agency across our home loan program, our new veterans home in Lebanon and the one in the Dalles, along with that claims and counseling system. This has been guiding our work as we bring on new staff and bring on both long-term staff and new staff, looking at how do we allocate current resources along these lines and along these deeper dive strategies. But want to give a heads up also, so an extra $2.4 million proposed in the governor's budget for ODVA and our local partners. So $2.4 million breaks out $300,000 to make sure that we're doing doubling down on our training of the county VSOs, making the $1 million outreach grant that came out of the last session, that was one-time funding that went down to the counties to make sure they were able to get out in front of the veterans to draw them into the benefit system, so continuing that $1 million outreach grant. $300,000 for statewide outreach, and then two policy analysts, geared towards health and well-being and one geared towards education and economic opportunity, to really try to be someone that can be in the meetings and build the relationships across those two what are still very broad policy buckets, but to be in that community to help mobilize those broader resources. And then an IT modernization project, both on database and to be able to help us identify veterans. There was an extra $2.1 million for debt service for the Lebanon Veterans Home that is more of an automatic given its debt service and bonding. But what I think beyond this generous investment, we feel the window closing as we draw down troops finally from Afghanistan, as we close down the most recent conflicts. And we are going to see, I think, just as we had in 2005 for many of you that were here, that significant infusion of state resources down to the county veteran service offices. I think you'll see county veteran service offices and the county commissioners making a good case that it is one of the highest leveraged uses of general fund dollars, both to draw down those federal VA resources and preserve state safety net services. But happy to take any questions at this time.
Thank you for that. Chair?
I have three questions.
Yes, sir.
First one is for Cameron, or for Director Smith. As we draw down resources, and you mentioned the governor's proposed budget, I think one of the statistics that jumps out
is the PTSD has come to the forefront. I think every member of both the House and the Senate committee has been dealing with this issue for 4 to 6 years, and it's about 4 years ago where it really became that this is a problem and we can put a real name on it and we're all going to agree to it, kind of like the argument is there climate change or not climate change. You know, we kind of got the thing with PTSD, it's there. That focus has been on that 6.6% of Afghan and Iraq veterans coupled in with the rest of the people in the war on terror, you know, out in Djibouti and other places. And there's been a big identification of that group of people. Having said that, though, the problem we're seeing, the challenge we're seeing now, once we've put a label and called it PTSD, as you point out, there's 37.2% of all veterans are from Vietnam, and we, in the last 18 months, we have just seen a huge swell into veterans hospitals and the mental health care programs of Vietnam veteran-era individuals now being diagnosed with PTSD. I mean, that is a six-fold increase of a group of individuals that we've just started to touch. And how do you see in the future we're going to deal with that?
So, Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, members of the committee, difficult and complex question, but a good one. Much of what we hear in the news is around that most recent generation of Iraq and Afghanistan, but it is the Vietnam veterans having re-engaged with the system, having not, when they first came home, and not have that welcome home. I think we're going to continue to see, both on the claim side and on the accessing healthcare and mental health resources, specifically around mental health, we see that spike of concern both for very young veterans and very old veterans. 50% of our veterans, so our 320,000 veterans across Oregon, 50% are 60 years old to 100. We have some good programs around skilled nursing with the home in the Dalles and standing up in Lebanon, but there's a broad range of aging veterans issues that we haven't always had expertise on our staff, but we're looking at some creative solutions using some of those other funds out of the veterans home to bring on some of that expertise, again, not to recreate programs, but to be our aging expert, linking to mental health, linking to OHA, linking to the public and private partners. We've often signaled, you know, everyone, most of our service members, military and veterans and their families, are strengthened by their service, but not a surprise that many can be impacted by their service. We've called out we're about 10% of the population in Oregon, but 25% of the suicides rate. So we have a long way to go to address those issues. But for a challenging issue, whether mental health, addiction, homelessness, not easy issues for us to wrap our mind around, and often using that military veterans lens helps convene the resources to do it.
As a follow-up question, you know, I'll just make a comment that for members to remember when we come in January and February is, I think, and Senator Monson can correct me, or one of the ranking members on the far right, Representative Witt or Representative Esquivel that have been here, we've invested about $10 million extra dollars in the Veterans Service Officer Program to get access to those federal benefits. And out of that $10 million in a decade, we have reaped almost $1 billion in a rate of return. $1 billion in a rate of return. And the vast majority of those were shifts from other programs in the state of Oregon to that veterans program, which therefore allowed some of our members here in the healthcare committees and the budget committees to shift those dollars over to other needy individuals. And that is a statement of fact. We have got to continue to not leave veterans benefits on the federal table, because we need every single one of those dollars for our other individuals. So just a kind of a statement of fact for folks, you know, a quick comment.
And chairs, members of the committee, there are two golden gooses, the two largest agencies at the federal level, being the Department of Defense and the federal VA. Our core expertise at ODVA is tapping into that federal VA resources. Where we will see a shift is there will still be strong family supports, but some of the reintegration programs won't be as long-lasting through DOD as they tighten up. Still a huge golden goose in terms of emergency management, the FEMA connections, the some $500 million, I think, of statewide impact salaries and facilities from Department of Defense for our leading element of the Guard. But those are two golden gooses for us to maintain our attention on.
Right. Two quick follow-up questions, I guess. One, General Hokanson, what is the anticipated return date of the 1,027 from the brigade coming back from Afghanistan? When do we think they're going to come back, roughly?
Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, members of the committee. Right now, sir, when they deployed, they were scheduled to come back in May or June. There are some decisions being made at the highest level right now. The 15th of December will be one decision, and as we've read in the news recently, the original cap was 9,800. They've increased that over 1,000. My other understanding is there's going to be a decision made around the 15th of April about the long-term window that our soldiers will be there. After the 15th, it's no longer considered a curtailment, but an early redeployment. So right now what we're doing and telling all the families is they're scheduled as planned to come back in May and June of next year. If they come back sooner, we'll be happy, but we just don't want to have them plan on that. We have been told that actually as early as this week, we've had groups of 6 and 8 return early because they're no longer needed. So of course, as they're no longer needed, we'll bring them back. But the majority of the forces we're still planning sure to come back in May and June.
Thank you. My one final question, Mr. Cooker, and this is really the point of my question. Can you give the committee a swag on this question? 2 years ago, I mean, we're still basically, for a better word, at 90 to 100% strength in all of our family programs that we're serving all service members. Marine Corps, basically the Guard has inherited every service member, including NOAA. In the Coast Guard, okay? And so 2 years ago, we were at a certain level. As example, in the Transition Assistance Program, we were at, I think, 12 to 14 individuals. We're now kind of lost it, and we're now back to 4. That's roughly a 70% cut in that program, as example, in the last 2 years. Those same sorts of cuts you're seeing elsewhere. I guess my question is come June of this next year, and December of this next year, 180 days after they come back, when we really see the problems of redeployment of 1,027 soldiers, how much do you think we're going to have been cut? I mean, we're seeing 70% someplace. This is a huge cut in which the state is going to inherit this problem.
Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, member of the committee, sir, you bring up an excellent point. One of the things that we're working toward is, unfortunately, the way it was funded previously is we had contracts, and when this first contract did not renew, I actually met with the Chief of National Guard Bureau 3 times one-on-one about this. And what they realized is the funding was great, but it was only year to year. And what we're looking for is long-term enduring solutions. And so we're trying to find those programs that are most successful, get the resources and long-term investment and the commitment at the federal level to employ these personnel. One of the things that we found is they spent over $125 million in one contracting zone. What they found is they could have hired the same employees for less than $1 million and then ensured that they were enduring. A perfect example of this is our psychological health care providers. They were under contract, but it was hard to retain the best quality employees because they were looking for long-term employment. They did change those positions to Title V, where now that person can establish a career and longevity with the organization. And now they're willing to stay because they see that they can be here for the long term. When we talk about the cuts, I really wish I knew. Without the National Defense Authorization Act being approved, we know that that funding will continue to decrease. The biggest concern as we have is the impacts of sequestration and the Budget Control Act. When you look at the Guard's budget alone, I think it was $6.7 billion last year. It's down to $6 billion this year. If the Budget Control Act, if we don't receive relief from that, it could be cut 30 to 40% next year in FY16, which will have a dramatic effect on the organization. This is where we get down to those decisions. Do we fund our units or do we fund our programs? And we exist because of our units, and so we'll have to find that right trade-off. That's right. I don't know the exact answer now. It'll really be budget-driven, and so we're looking towards Friday and then the days that occur after that to see if we get a positive resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Cooker.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Yes.
So I've got a couple things, you know, because when you, Cameron, when you put up the number and you break out the veterans by service era, and, you know, you see this kind of small percent as being post-9/11, I mean, still 22,000 people in our state. It's a significant population, and particularly for those of us who are up here looking at potentially 50 to 60 years of lifespan left on those folks. And, you know, we haven't solved the problems of you know, post-war issues for Vietnam-era vets, and this is ongoing for 40 years, and we're still seeing a population of people who can't access health care. We're seeing the PTSD, like you heard Senator Boquist say. But now we're talking about people who've done multiple deployments, who've really shouldered this burden in a very different way than Vietnam-era vets have, and a 50 to 60-year challenge around, you know, health care, mental health, and all of the other, you know, issues that come with it. We know what those issues are. So, you know, curious to see, and you might not have an answer for this, but I really would like to see, you know, what a long-term kind of vision plan looks like for how we don't make a lot of those same mistakes that have been made over the last 40 years. So that's kind of more of a comment than a question to you. But I'm also concerned about some of these micro groups that keep popping up within you know, who've got different types of military service that are not being addressed. We saw that last year with the folks who were the Korean Marines, and we still have not addressed their health care issues. Seeing it with other, you know, groups of, you know, we did this specific job in the military and we're having these kind of specific issues. The VA is not addressing those. I think we're going to see more of those in the future, and I'd like us to come up with, and again, these are more comments than questions, but I'd like us to come up with a plan for how we can start looking to address those things at the state. I would still, although I don't have a bill draft for it, I would still like us to address the issue with that group of Korean Marines, because clearly the VA is not doing it. And the last kind of more comment than anything for us to start thinking about is, you know, we've privatized a lot of this war, and we have contractors out there who've done a lot of work on behalf of this country who have no longer with their, you know, mega contractors who certainly made a lot of money to, you know, be engaged in this war. And, you know, in my own family, my brother was in the Army, and when he got out, he ended up going back as a contractor, spent 4 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. And my dad, in his 60s, spent 18 months in Iraq as a contractor because he speaks fluent English, Arabic, and French, and they needed translators who, you know, were not from Pakistan or wherever. They wanted American translators there. That whole population, while they didn't wear the uniform, certainly did the work. And I think we're going to see some of those same issues. And I think our VA is going to have a plan for people who did that kind of work and served beside people who actually wore the uniform. And to not have both conversations, I think, is going to be problematic. We're going to start seeing, and I'm starting to hear from people who have been contractors, not my family, but others who've been contractors and who've done the work. They are starting to have problems, and there is no mechanism to address their issues. So just those are more comment than anything as we continue to plan, because I think you're right. The money, and General Hulkinson certainly, the money's going away. I have no real legislative concepts this year for veterans because mine is happening outside of the building to try to solve that problem. But it is clearly, if we don't lock some funds away permanently, we're going to have a huge problem in this state, given that even our Vietnam-era veterans have another, you know, 20, 25, 30 years of lifespan left, and the problems are continuing to mount, and particularly in kind of old age.
Thank you for that, and I'm sure there's a response. Gentlemen, I just really want to stay on time, if you don't mind. Right. We're running out.
Put it in the file.
Thank you so much, General, for your time today. Thank you very much, and Mr. Smith, as always a pleasure. Thank you,
sir. Thank you, sir.
Next up is the update on implementation of ORS 408.237. It's job interviews for veterans, House Bill 3207 from 2011. This will certainly be one that I think you'll be working on for quite some time as a committee. So, again, we're at 10:40 now. We have to be out by 11. And that doesn't leave us a whole great deal of time, but we have this panel and then a very brief summary of potential bills from the Oregon Military Department and ODVA. So with that, if you will, please, if you can begin. We have about 10 minutes, and I'm sorry to cut you short, but let's see what we can do. Thank you.
We can do it in five. I was hostile last time. They want to leave.
Okay.
Good morning. Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm a senior policy advisor with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, but I'm here today as a representative of the stakeholder working group that worked on legislative concept 1181, which is the veterans preference legislative concept. Over the past 8 months, 13 stakeholders put together a consensus-driven and comprehensive approach to veterans' preference, which is now that legislative concept. It's a carefully considered and comprehensive approach to applying veterans' preference in public employment. As I've testified before, the current statutes are unclear confusing and provide no real guidance on implementation for public employers. So the statutes were essentially rewritten. The result is a meaningful, clear, and uniform method by which a public employer gives special consideration to qualified veterans and disabled veterans, and there's no known fiscal impact on that. An important goal for the stakeholders was to ensure that qualified and competitive veterans and disabled veterans receive no less than the level of special consideration that's provided in current statutes. For the veteran, LC 1181 applies a fair and meaningful preference at every key stage in the hiring process and creates more defined opportunities for veterans to have an initial interview. Preference is applied at three key stages in the process: the initial interview stage and the final, the evaluation stage, and at the final selection process. Preference moves veterans ahead of other non-veteran applicants, and disabled veterans are given a greater preference than veterans. The initial interview stage is emphasized because in LC 1181, because it provides the best opportunity for a veteran to describe their military skills and experience and explain those to a hiring manager. And it reinforces the purposes and the intent of House Bill 3207 from 2011. There are three new and significant benefits to veterans that are provided in this concept. First, the requirement that employers interview at least five veterans during an unscored hiring process. Second is the requirement that an employer give the same weight to a veteran's transferable skills as the employer gives to skills from civilian experience. And the third benefit is during the final selection stage, if a veteran or a disabled veteran is equally or better qualified than the applicant, the employer must offer the benefit, position to the veteran. Currently, only certain processes give that particular hiring preference to veterans. LC 1181 provides that particular kind of preference across all hiring processes. For the public employer, it outlines clear and straightforward methods to apply veterans' preference that the employer can implement and explain. The stakeholder group needed to design methods for applying veterans' preference that can be used by all public employers, the state, large cities, small cities, counties, police and fire districts, and governmental authorities. Public employers in Oregon all have different procedures and different terminology for hiring processes, and we came to a universal language that will work for everyone. One of the strongest components of LC 1181 is that it provides legislative intent, policy, and purpose to mitigate the issues about legislative intent that are currently in statutes. There are two important issues in the hiring process that are addressed, and one is the concept of applying veterans' preference at every stage in the hiring process, and the second is that a public employer must provide every qualified veteran with an interview. As to the first issue, there's nothing in the current veterans' preference statutes that suggests or requires the application of veterans' preference at every stage of the hiring process. It just doesn't exist. The requirement that a public employer apply preference at every stage is only an interpretation. It's not in statute. The bill, the proposed legislation addresses this issue by requiring public employers to apply veterans' preference at three key stages, with a focus on the initial interview. The methods provide a fair and meaningful preference that the current statute does not have, and it moves veterans ahead of non-veterans. The second is the interpretation that every qualified veteran must be interviewed. That also demonstrates the problems with the inconsistent language in the current statutes, because the statutes can easily be interpreted to mean that every qualified and competitive veteran must be interviewed. As I described to these committees before, interviewing every veteran who's minimally qualified has two unintended consequences. For large applicant pools in Multnomah County, for example, they have 1,000 or more applicants for entry-level positions. It's inefficient and not cost-effective for employers to interview all qualified veterans. That would number 50, 75, 100 veterans for one single entry-level position. Interviewing large numbers of veterans doesn't serve veterans well. It requires unnecessary sacrifices for the veteran, including time and expenses for travel or lost wages, and gives the veteran false hope about their chances for a job, because to most people, an interview means that you have a reasonable chance of getting the job. If 50 veterans are being interviewed for a job, the reality is that the veteran does not have a reasonable chance at that job because they're competing against other applicants and 50 other veterans. The concept resolved this issue by applying a meaningful preference. During the evaluation stage, the public employer considers skills, training, experience, and knowledge that a veteran or disabled veteran has that make the veteran competitive, and then uses that preference to move them up ahead of other applicants, giving veterans more of an opportunity for an interview. I wanted to acknowledge the stakeholders that are part of this group. I am merely the spokesperson here. We had five stakeholders that are veterans or have served in the military. We had Department of Administrative Services, ODVA, Oregon Military Department, League of Oregon Cities, Multnomah County, City of Portland. We had also five attorneys on the group, which always makes things interesting. It was really a hard working group. They spent 8 months on this project. It is a clear, good project. In your packet, there is a report that has a really detailed and comprehensive evaluation of this. I wanted to provide a record for the committee so they could look at the bill. And in it, there are these two charts that show you the methods for applying veterans' preference. That's down in the weeds. How do you do this? But if you look at the legislative concept, a public employer or a veteran could pick up the statute, read it, and understand it, and figure out how veterans' preference was going to be applied. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Sparks, did you have anything to add to this?
I do.
Please do, and keep in mind the interest of time. That
I will be very quick.
Thank you.
For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The Bureau of Labor and Industries, our mission is to protect employment rights, advance employment opportunities, and protect access to housing in public places free from discrimination. This includes protecting veterans' rights in hiring and employment. BOLI stands firm that the veteran's preference means that employers should interview every qualified veteran. To ensure that the veteran's preference is meaningful, the agency also believes that the veteran's preference should apply throughout the hiring process. I think that there are many areas where we agree with sort of the current draft that is out there, LC 1181. We do think there should be some changes to make it clear for public employers that they can sort of tighten up on what it means to be qualified, and you are only interviewing people who would meet those qualifications. But there's some language in the draft that refers to the employer's sole discretion that makes us a little uncomfortable. There's also the reality that a lot of initial interviews can just be screening processes. We want to make sure that veterans are truly being given opportunities and a preference to move up in these processes. We oppose efforts to weaken the law. We are committed to moving this forward, but we also understand that this is complicated for public employers. We believe that we have reached a compromise with some stakeholders, and we are working on amendments to reflect that compromise.
Thank you. This should be fun for 2015. Did you have anything you'd like to add, sir?
Very quickly, Chair Matthews, Chair Brokquist, Andy Smith from the Association of Oregon Counties, and I think the counties are delighted at what this work group was able to do. If you look at this, I like pictures. This is page 9 of your report, and there are three gray areas. One of those gray areas was there in terms of where this preference is applied in the statutes. Two of those are new. They're kind of explicitly laid out. So I think we buttressed the statute. I think the proposed LC would make it stronger because it's more explicit. And we worked with our members. I think their main concern is they want to do the right thing. They just didn't have a roadmap. And I really do think that this work group very clearly, statutes really do this, but gets to the point where it's clear now. There are 3 points that we're going to apply this in the statute. This isn't on the eligibility side. This is more of a subjective, qualitative hiring side of things. But it's that, as Lori outlined, there are 3 places that we would do that in the statute. Before, the statute really only, if you looked at it very closely, it was probably one spot that it did it. So we've added 2 instances that everybody has to do it.
We've got a standard across the state. So I think, you know, all of the players that we had, all the HR speak that was going out, all the lawyer speak, all the agency work, you know, we had all these stakeholders, and I know we're trying to, you know, bully a few of these issues. I think they're very small, but I think that was a great deal of progress. I think we've made a big jump. So I'm happy
Thank
to be
you.
Here.
And, you know, today was basically going to just kind of give us an update on the implementation of the ORS, but it really felt like a committee hearing where you're trying to explain and justify why you have this bill before us, which you don't. You have an LC, and you'll be dealing with that next...
2015,
sir. And I wish you the best of luck. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Boone and I have been on this committee for quite some time, and I can't tell you how many times this conversation has come up. And it always seems to be the public sector. And it's very irritating to me that the public sector would be the worst offender of not allowing veterans to have a chance. And it seems like we've done this for 8 years now, I think. Something like that, Representative. I hope this gets to the end of the problem and alleviates it, because personally, I'm getting tired of hearing about it. Now, if we have to, we better change the mindset of the public sector.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your work on this. And as we've talked in the past, it seems to largely come down to the term qualified, as you pointed out, and getting a good definition on that. And as a longtime member of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, I've, you know, take every chance I can on the record to remind DAS and others that, you know, you've got to be realistic. I've been an employer my whole adult life, 45 years. I've employed people, and I know what it takes to make a good employee. And a lot of the job descriptions that you've
seriously, yeah.
You know, and they're just not realistic. You don't need some of the qualifications that they demand for some of the state jobs, and we need to really make progress on that. So thanks again.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, did you have anything?
2015.
Thank you for your time today.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
That. And, did I give Representative Boone?
Well, I'll let you say what you're going to say.
No, feel free, please.
Okay. All I did was comment. I said, you're not 45. And but before you close out, I would like to personally thank you, Mr. Chair, for your leadership and your leadership in this committee and everything that you've
We have one
us.
More panel, too, Representative.
Oh, we do?
We do, yeah.
All right, well,
the military department's coming forward.
I'm sorry.
I'm excited to hear what you have to say.
Yeah.
Don't get me all choked up. So timeline rules apply to everybody?
One.
But in this case, it was everybody else, unfortunately. So here you are on the last of the leg here.
We can do this.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Chair Boquist, Chair Matthews, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Foray, Deputy Director of Oregon Military Department. With me today is Sean McCormick from our Office of Emergency Management. We're going to provide you a very brief overview of five legislative concepts we're proposing that have to do with the emergency management area.
Good afternoon. Good morning, Chair Matthews, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sean McCormick. I'm the Section Manager of Mitigation and Recovery Services at the Office of Emergency Management. Before I begin, please note you have been provided a one-page document which summarizes each of our measures and discusses the fiscal impact of each. Also, our office is still awaiting a formal response from the Governor's Office associated with each of these measures. Legislative Concept 498 requests a statutory language change to ORS 403 to allow OEM to invest in technologies to help transition our 43 public safety answering points off of the current analog system, which is rapidly approaching end of life, and moving it towards a digital IP-based system. This language change is required as current statutory language only allows for investment in enhanced or analog technologies and does not provide for the flexibility to invest in any new or soon-to-be-developed technologies. Legislative Concept 499 requests a change to ORS 801.260 to allow emergency management vehicles and emergency service vehicles the use of red or amber lights and sirens as they approach as they travel to an incident. This is a life safety issue in terms of helping our critical first responders arrive in a way that's safe for both them and the public at large. We're working in joint with the state police, the state fire marshal, and the Department of Transportation in the creation of this concept. Again, I do want to stress this request only applies to red and amber lights and not blue lights, which are traditionally associated with state and local police forces. Legislative Concept 500 is an Oregon Military Department housekeeping measure associated with ORS 401.358, and it seeks to remove the specific reference to the Oregon State Defense Force. We believe the removal of this specific organization from statute really does ensure consistency with the overall scope of the statute while not diminishing its intent or meaning. LC 501 develops a voluntary consumer point of sale Oregon Outdoor Recreation Search and Rescue Card program. This program will be developed jointly by OEM and the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Revenue raised by this voluntary program would be used to reimburse search and rescue costs incurred by county sheriffs, search and rescue costs incurred by OEM, and to finance any operational costs associated with managing the CARD program. We're currently working with Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Revenue, and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association in the development of this measure. Our final concept, LC 502, is a housekeeping measure associated with ORS 401.532 and 401.534. The concept seeks to change the title of the Oregon Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund to the Oregon Emergency Preparedness Account and place that account along with the Oregon Disaster Response Fund within the general fund as opposed to separate and distinct from the general fund. This concept will result, we hope, in improved accounting processes inside of our office as well as allowing for us to accommodate a request made by FEMA some years ago to change the title of the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund based on the types of funds that go into that account. And that concludes my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions. I hope I did that quick enough.
Wow. Nice. Very nicely done. Are you interested in talking about resiliency or the Ebola virus in the same fashion?
Absolutely.
No, thank you very much. Mr. Chair?
No, I have nothing.
Anything? Members of the committee?
For auctions.
Well done, and Cameron Smith now joins you. Mr. Smith, sir.
Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cameron Smith, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and we have LC 504, which is a housekeeping amendment, repealing outdated statutes. We have LC 505, which will allow us to be a rep payee and pay bills for veterans out of their either Social Security or federal VA benefits out of our conservatorship program. LC 509 will be a home loan mediation fix for us as a home loan provider. And then LC 510, a question before us to keep the records that we get from veterans, whether through other agencies or themselves, to be able to keep that information private and not release it. These are proposed to the governor, and we should see them in 2015.
Great.
And more importantly, I want to steal Representative Boone's thunder and thank the good outgoing chair. We would not be able to get the chair to come to a ceremony in his honor, so we are cannibalizing this end of the committee hearing on the record to thank you for your service, both in the military and as a veterans and military advocate. We have often seen a lot of folks that want to march at the head of the parade, but you have been a true veterans advocate doing the hard work on their behalf. And on behalf of the Oregon National Guard and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, we have a presentation. We don't have a Myrtlewood plaque, but we have dog tags presented by the Guard.
Wow.
It says, Representative Greg Matthews, House District 50, 2008 to 2014, Chair, House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee, a true veterans advocate. Thank you for your service to all Oregon veterans and their families. You'll be missed.
Oh,
thank
wow.
you. Really cool. Thank you. Wow.
That's cool.
That's very cool.
Very cool. So this is how it ends. Representative Huffman.
Can I mention a concept real quick?
Sir.
It's not going to be a committee bill, but it's going to be introduced. It's going to be a comprehensive bill to take care of all of the balance of Oregon highways in the name of veterans. And there are going to be four highways, Purple Heart Trail and others. And so I'll have that coming and have support of ODVA and ODOT already ahead of the game so that we should be able to sail right through with it.
Excellent. Well done. Representative Boone.
Okay, now I will finish. And I don't have a plaque, but Cameron, that was very cool, and thank you for doing that.
Very cool.
But thank you, Mr. Chair, for everything you've done guiding us through two different sectors, and I appreciate all your hard work, all your service, and I wish you the best being chief, and hope I never have to run into you professionally. Stay in touch with us, will you?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Senator.
Yes. First, I'd like to mention that we have the bill for the military museum
and Camp Withicum if you haven't signed onto it and would like to. And secondly, I'd like to thank Greg personally for the work last year, or 2 years ago, on the college bill for the honorably discharged.
Great work on that, sir.
That was fun. Thank you.
Good luck. Representative Escobar.
You know, I've waited a long time for this.
You know,
oh, boy.
And I'll tell you something that...
You've been waiting for me to leave for 6 years.
It's been a great ride. You show your sincerity and your feelings for veterans, and that's very special. More importantly, you're our friend, and we're going to miss you. And we hope that you will be back with us. But more importantly, whatever you do in life, you'll be just fine, Greg, because you're a good person.
Thank you. Thank you.
As the chief, you need to shave a little more off.
Those late nights getting to you there?
Yeah, that's what it's all about. Mr. Chair?
I, on behalf of all the senators, I greatly appreciate your leadership in the Veterans Committee from the upper chamber over there. And we look forward to your continued off-site participation in veterans benefits, including the hand grenade you gave me a note about, because we still need every veteran in the state to participate in the process. And thank you again for your service.
Thank you. I'll just say, and thank you, Cheyenne Ross, I just got to say, amazing work. And Elizabeth Edwards was wonderful for the committee. But this group of individuals, Senate vets, House vets, the most honorable folks to work with. Really doing great work. And, you know, when I first came in 2009, I was coming to my first committee, and I had the privilege of walking down the hall coming out of the meeting with Representative Escobar. And I remember saying to him, we're going to do some great things for veterans. And he looked at me and he says, we've been doing great things for veterans. And, and it's true. And he continues to march, and I really look up to him, and he's been a great friend, as you all have. I really hope that we do continue to press forward for veterans. I do believe that the state does have a window of opportunity, and that window is closing daily. We need to all recognize that. I push, as you saw, 14 LCs drafted concepts moving forward for the House to continue its own Veterans Committee. Absolutely needs to happen. These are critical issues with critical people involved. If we could get half the audience that we had earlier today to attend veterans on a regular basis, to push those issues forward for the troops and for their families, we'd be in a whole lot better place. So I appreciate all the work you're doing. Cameron Smith, this means the world to me. Our vets are in good shape with you at the helm, sir. And congratulations on job well done, and continue the great work. And this is how we go out. So with that, we will close our interim committee. And so I'll close the House side, sir. And I'll close the interim committee on veterans emergency preparedness. Truly been an honor. God bless the veterans.
And the Senate committee is closed, too. Thank you. Well done. Well done. Closed, too. Thank you.